the download. Former Chicago Bear Israel Adonijé, our resident philosopher Al Genie, and our new Thursday edition of the Swap Meet with Greg Flam. Now, here's your host, a man whose New Year's resolution was to stop being introduced, Justin Kaufman. Who's the man? Who's the
man? Who's the man? Oh, rats. There goes that resolution.
Happy New Year, everybody. Justin Kaufman here. It's a download with you till 11 o'clock tonight here on 720 WGN. Great to be back in the seat here for 2018. Pete Zimmerman's here as well. It's nice to be back. It's nice and cozy in this room right here on beautiful Michigan Avenue. It's so cold outside. I went across to the Freshie and the Walgreens. I don't know, man. I'm rethinking that choice. The minute I hit that gusty wind that just went like a power fan down Michigan Avenue, just blowing right in my face. But you know what? We're Chicagoans. We can handle it. At least we're not on the East or West Coast right now dealing with other anomalies that are winter-related, earthquakes or snow hurricanes. Looking forward to tonight's show. We got a great one lined up. It's great to be back. Pete, good to see you. Happy New Year. Thanks for coming back, I guess.
Happy New Year to you, and happy to be back.
Right?
Of course, yeah.
It's good to see you. It's good to be back in the chair. It feels good. I miss it. It's funny because at the beginning of I tried for the break that we were on to really limit the time working. You know, like that was it's vacation time, it's time with family.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, but it's tough to not pull out the computer and be like, well, let me look ahead to January. Who can we book at this time? That kind of stuff. And the last 2 days, because I sat in yesterday with Roe, but, you know, we were back working on Tuesday. It's just been nonstop. I feel like I'm already to February. We're booking people. So many great guests coming through here in the next month and a half. It's amazing to me. It just keeps coming at us like an avalanche. And it's so fun to think about the different people in Chicago and other places that we could talk to and interview and tell their stories. So they're going to have some tremendous stuff coming up here on the download in the next month and a half. And of course, through the rest of 2018. And all that's coming up. Tonight, Israel Adonijé joins us, one of our favorites here on the download, the former Chicago Bear turned serial entrepreneur. Last time he was in, he was talking about his series of books for kids. Tonight, we talk about his work on teaching kids coding. So he's working with his charity, but he's done so many different things. He's my guest on the download in Chicago Business. We'll talk about what it takes to really approach starting new businesses and continuing his old ones. Israel Adonijé on the show tonight. Al Genie's going to join us, the resident philosopher to the download. He joins us from time to time. Love when Al comes through. We're going to talk tonight about satire and how important it is to any society, regardless of your political partisan affiliations. It's important to have that voice, and it's one that has persevered throughout human history. It's not something new. You know, we think about, you see this all the time with social media and platforms that are just inundating us with comedians trying to make jokes about the Trump administration, people getting upset, saying it's unfair, this, that, and the other. But you go back, and Al goes back, and this has been back to the Ming dynasties of China. It goes way back in human civilizations, to the pyramids and the Egyptians. And Al has sussed all this stuff out. He's researched. Of course, he wrote the book, The Importance of Being Funny. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about that with Al, about how important satire has been to human society and how important it is coming up here in 2018. And, you know, what's good political satire when you're in the era of Trump? So we'll talk about that coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. 9 o'clock tonight, oh, man, Adam Hogue. We usually do the Monday evening quarterback to Thursday evening quarterback. So we'll talk about what the Bears are looking for in a new head coach. Of course, when we were out, John Fox shown the door. The Chicago Bears in the hunt for a new wonder kid. I don't know what we're looking for when it comes to coach of the Bears. Do you want the 22-year-old kid who's like, I know how to X's and O's. I figured it out on my gamepad. Or do we want the grizzled veteran who used to play on the 85 Bears? That's what we got to ask ourselves. So, or something in between. We'll talk to Adam Hogue because he's got already today the Chicago Bears brass up in Minnesota talking to both the offensive coordinator and the defensive coordinator. You know, I already talked with Vic Fangio, the present day defensive coordinator for the Chicago Bears. So and already Josh McDaniels has been shown. So many different names are being thrown about. We'll talk with Adam Hoge about what we saw this season 2017, and of course what we can look forward to in 2018 when they get a coach, and what the Bears need to do to be competitive, to be that LA Rams team that everybody thinks the Bears can be the year after this dismal 2017 season. So that's coming up as well. And tonight, I'm so excited about this too. We made a strategic decision here at The Download, and that is to give a new day in time. Well, time's the same. New day, same time for Greg Flamm and the Swap Meet. He is now a Thursday night fixture here at 720 WGN. Greg Flamm, of course, the man behind the Swap Meet, where you can call up and we will, if you got collectibles, memorabilia, junk, we'll evaluate it for you. We'll tell you if it's worth anything. We've been doing this on Wednesday nights all through 2017, and we determined that we wanted to make it a little fresh, give Thursday night a little.
Yeah.
Swap meet.
So that's nothing else is going, you know, no friends in Seinfeld, no family ties to tune into.
This is like when Wings was on Wednesday and it was a hot thing on Wednesdays, and you're like, you know, this should be on Thursdays.
Yeah.
We should really put this on right before Frasier.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing. We're moving.
And then Veronica's closet.
Then the single guy, right? So all that coming up tonight. Wow, that's a good show lined up here for our return 2018 inaugural voyage. The Download here on 720 WGN. News, weather, and traffic with our familiar voices, Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by my man Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. So stay with us. It's a Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Why don't we do this? Why don't we carry out? Here are today's top stories. The White House lawyers have filed a cease and desist against the author of a new explosive tell-all book on the Trump administration. Excerpts have already been published that feature Steve Bannon talking smack about treason, insider info about how much Trump dyes his hair, and why the president eats at McDonald's. He's afraid of being poisoned, which is funny because there are short-term and long-term poisonings. Maybe he chose the latter. So what does all of it mean? Well, I'm not sure that would have any staying power. Tell-all books don't hang around for that long. But the administration is doing everything they can to make this book the new Bible. Cease and desist, long, rambly statements about how Bannon sucks, and another round of crackdowns on cell phones in the White House. And you get the feeling that maybe, just maybe, some of these stories in the book might be real. And if just a sliver are true, there are a lot of people in the White House that really don't like their boss. But that boss is winning. He's taking credit for talks in Korea, North and South, and the stock market is up over 25,000. And if that continues, we won't care much about tweets, cell phone bans in the future. But who are we kidding? The media will just change the story to, why isn't the Dow at 30,000? And Korea's nothing. What is Trump doing about Mongolia? You know that's going to be the case. With all the positive news about legal marijuana in California, the Justice Department and Jeff Sessions have just had enough. Sessions is rolling back Obama-era guidelines on how the feds look at states legalizing pot. There was a policy that essentially said that they were hands-off, but Sessions wants to get his hands on the sticky icky. So if you live in California, I wouldn't give up that medical marijuana card that you got for ankle anxiety just yet. The big takeaway, this will give federal prosecutors the ability to prosecute marijuana cases at their own discretion. Yeah, that won't break bad when you're giving federal prosecuting discretionary limit. All right. Yeah. Come on, man. You never want to hear that. We just like to give a prosecutor whatever he wants to do. He can figure it out. We don't want the law to be involved at all. Just figure it out. The feds are suing cities like Chicago for being sanctuary cities, which means that city police won't hold undocumented immigrants if picked up for crimes. The city's police force says, that's your issue, ICE. We're already up to our eyeballs in fighting crime. This lawsuit says that if the city wants federal grants, they got to cooperate. Once again, this administration seems to be cherry-picking the state versus federal argument. When it's immigration or marijuana, it's a federal issue. If it's health care or abortion or guns, well, that should be a state issue. Pick a lane. E. coli is back in the news. It's shown up in a couple of states, and the culprit seems to be romaine lettuce. Rebecca Romaine Lettuce. One of the states is Illinois, but no recall has been offered up. Instead, the feds say there's not enough evidence that it is romaine. And you know what? Just pick a different lettuce. That's essentially what they said. So now the man's going to tell me that I can't have regular lettuce? What, you going to make me buy the frou-frou stuff? The arugula? First the tax plan, then Icelandic yogurt? Now arugula? That's it. I'm leaving the state. Where's my dream op-ed? I'm leaving right now. Closer to home, gubernatorial candidate Chris Kennedy called out Mayor Emanuel for purposely pushing gentrification, forcing blacks and Latinos out of the city of Chicago. This, of course, in an effort for Kennedy to appeal to minority voters in the upcoming election, voters who really don't like the mayor to begin with. Weird, because weren't the Kennedys in power when white flight was happening in the 50s and 60s? Nah, but he's progressive now, got it. You know Chris Kennedy, the social justice warrior who once owned the biggest building in the world? Okay. CPS is dealing with gift card fraud, gift cards meant for students that were used by administrators. This story seems to be popping up every year. It's replacing the "look at all these new books thrown out in the dumpster" story that usually comes in June. No, these are brand new bikes. The saran wrap's still on them. Get Pam Zekman on this story. Here's the real story. People like to steal. I don't know what to tell you. Governor Rauner's taking a break from campaigning, or has he? The governor is staying at a veterans home in Quincy that's been the center of a Legionnaires' disease outbreak. To prove how much he cares, Rauner is staying there for a few nights, Jane Byrne style. Has anyone asked for that? Like, did I miss it over the holidays? They're like, if he cares so much, he should stay there. There's never, no comment, no one. I'd love to be in that meeting where they're like, what if you stayed there, governor? Now that's what I'm talking about. Not sure. No word on whether or not Rauner will hang out in the common room after Mahjong, or if we'll keep the door open to his room so we can all hear Judge Judy on full blast. My question is, if the governor contracts Legionnaires, does he get workers' comp? That's a pretty good question. The candidates are revealing their economic interests before the upcoming elections, by law, of course, and this shows up way too much. Let's single out the assessor, Joe Barrios, for this. But he revealed that his side job is lobbying Springfield on behalf of law firms, Pace Bus, Comcast, and an Illinois gaming machine company. The tax assessor has a side job where he tried to get better deals for slot machines. only in Illinois, right? I know he's not the only one who lobbies on the side, but come on. I mean, it just seems like an easy loophole to fix. If you hold elective office, you can't represent companies that want business from elected offices. Seems legit. And if you can't part with that business, don't run for office. It's me, right? It's them. It's not me. The guy from the Menkmans. It's him, right? Not me. All right, and weather. And let's pray to the weather gods. Ready? Dear Overlord, Ms. Justin, I don't know if you can hear me, but I promise that I will never again take Chicago summers for granted. Just make it 40 again, please. Thanks. Geez, but if cold's the worst we get in Chicago, I'll take it. Winter hurricanes in the east, earthquakes and droughts in the west, I'll take the cold. It's okay. We're okay. In sports, the Blackhawks are back, baby. They got a big win last night in New York against the Rangers. This is the beginning of a run. I can feel it. It also could be the romaine lettuce I just ate for dinner. But no, I think it's the gut feeling that the Hawks are going to turn it on starting now. After making it seem like they could beat almost anybody, the Bulls have come back down to earth, or to at least their normal losing ways. Lost again last night, three in a row now. Sure, they can beat the Hornets, and maybe the Milwaukee Bucks. But they've lost to the Cavs, Celtics, Raptors, and Trailblazers over the Christmas break. Only good news, Zach LaVine, the singer from Maroon 5, almost back. Oh, that's not. No, it's a different. He was the guy that the main guy we traded Jimmy Butler for to Minnesota. And he should be back maybe next week, the week after, or in March. I can't figure out what they're doing there. The Bears are interviewing the Minnesota Viking coordinators today. No. They interviewed Fangio yesterday, which everyone's calling a courtesy interview. I'd be okay with Fangio as head coach, but am I the only fan that would like to see a coach with a little personality? A Joe Madden type, maybe? Sick of the stoic football coach that doesn't like talking to the media. That's got to go. We want a young Dicka. Or heck, hire Ozzie Guillen. Right? That's what we want as the Bears coach. Ozzie Guillen. That would be great. Right now, the Bears are tied to a lot of Doogie Howser type coaches. The ones that have figured out how to throw a 12-yard pass on a 3rd and 10. Geniuses! The odds makers, yep, there are odds makers for this. Say the Vikings' Pat Shurmur, no. And the Chiefs' Matt Nagy are the favorites. No Ozzie Guillen on that list. I can't believe it. I'm hoping that the Panthers blow it this weekend. And Ron Rivera jumps ship because they're forcing the owner to sell the team. Then boom, Chico Rivera back in Chicago. He brings a bunch of those Panther linebackers with and Cam Newton. Boom. I just say football. Speaking of Madden, what's with baseball free agency? The hot stove a little bit out of gas. Teams are being conservative. Nobody signed anywhere, including Jake Arrieta. Come on, guys. Pull the trigger. The Cubs and Sox have been pretty quiet over the last month. Although this just crossed the wire. The Sox were in a three-team trade today. The Royals and the Dodgers. And the Dodgers got... The Royals, they got... Well, the Sox, hey, we got a guy. We got Joaquin Soria. That's a great deal. It was 2007. But if he pitches well, we'll trade him. But here, I got it. Ready? Arrieta to the Cubs. Yu Darvish to the Sox. Boom, done. 6 weeks till we report to spring training. I just fixed baseball. And you better move quick, Cubs fans. Arrieta tied to the Cardinals. Oof. Could you imagine that? Dexter Fowler and Jake Arrieta in St. Louis. And finally tonight, the Punky QB is heading for the Vegas stage. Am I reading this right? Jim McMahon's going to be part of a new show called Renegades that features other bad boy athletes in a talk show format, Vegas hotel. No word on what Jim McMahon's going to do, but if it's anything like his football career, he'll probably get hurt. Terrible. That's the carryout for January 4th, 2018. Are you excited for 2018? We've got some Black Eyed Peas left over for good luck. In this case, you're going to need the good luck because we cooked them on Monday and they've been sitting out for like 4 days. Happy New Year. All right, coming up, Israel Adonijé joins us. Talk to him about his new venture to try and get Chicago kids to code and also about what it takes to be a serial entrepreneur. He's my guest on the Download on Chicago Business. It's coming up here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier. Awesome. Good to see you, buddy. How are you?
Happy 2018.
How about it?
Yeah.
How were the holidays? Good for you?
Not too bad. You know, not too...
I heard you. You were in the building, though. I heard you a couple times.
Yes. I was here.
You're a professional.
I try.
Like us, or weasels like myself are like, I'm going to be gone for a week and a half.
I wouldn't call you a weasel at all. If I had an opportunity to do that, I would have done the same thing. Except I burned all my vacation time early.
Yeah.
You know how that goes.
I do.
Yeah.
You had a good time?
Yeah. Nice to see your son today. I saw him. He had the Switch.
He did. He's got
Santa was good
Switch,
to him, yeah. Looked like. Yeah.
Yep. And he was out visiting his grandparents in Wisconsin, and he didn't have the Switch with him.
Oh.
So it was a big deal that he came home, and I brought it with because I caught him up at the – I got him at the train station.
Right.
And I had it in my hand, so I got Dad of the Year 2018 over a video game.
Was he twitching up there without the Switch?
He really was. There's nothing worse than when you give the video game, like you brought it, and you're like, look what I did. And he's like, oh, thanks, Dad. I love you. And I'm like, really? That's what did it? That I brought the video game? Yeah. Okay. I'll take it. Still.
Love it. Love it. It's business time. It's business. It's business time. I don't know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time.
It's the Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's time for the Download on Chicago Business, our weekly segment that features entrepreneurs and CEOs telling us their stories so we can better understand ours. Tonight, a return engagement with one of our favorites here on the Download, Israel Adonijé. Adonijé is well known to Chicagoans for his tenure with the Chicago Bears, but Adonijé has built a life outside of football, one that finds him starting small businesses like supplying communion cups to churches and religious organizations or creating an Ask a Doctor service, connecting people to healthcare specialists via the internet to answer pressing medical questions. And if that's not enough, how about running a new co-working event space called Work Vault in the South Loop? And last time he was here, he was talking about his line of books for kids. It's an amazing resume for an athlete turned serial entrepreneur, and it continues to develop. Tonight, we talk about his latest project for IF Charities, his charity, partnering with Codeverse to teach at-risk youth the language of the internet. Coding is how to build websites and applications, and is becoming a prereq in some schools around the country, as some project And as some project that this skill will produce hundreds of thousands of jobs over the course of the next few decades, here in Chicago, CPS has done a lot with teaching code. But if Charities takes it further by offering up free classes and ways for kids to share their product, Israel Adonishe, my guest on The Download in Chicago Business. Israel, thanks for being here.
Justin, what's going on? How are you?
Good, man. Good. Happy New Year. So there's so much going on, and I want to ask you, a lot of questions about, you know, being an entrepreneur. But let's first talk about the IF code, the thing that you're putting together with IF Charities that you partner with Codeverse. Why is this skill building opportunity important to you?
Well, just, I think although I'm not proficient in coding myself, I've realized through some of the things that I've been fortunate to be involved with that it's really the future, and it's going to be one of those pivotal occupations in the future of you know, our world, really. Those that have the ability to speak that language, to code, will forever have jobs, and there's, so much, even as far as just building websites and doing simple things, that companies will have developers and engineers and people that can code and do things in-house. So I wanted to, through IF Charities, focused on, you talk about economic development, providing opportunities for our kids for the future, provide that skill set to kids in our community and position them for what will be millions of jobs, actually, that'll be available in years to come.
Yeah, and I was going to say, you do so much with social learning and SEL and everything in between. When you talk about trying to help kids who are at-risk youth in Chicago with so many different parts of their life, whether it be recreation or physical education or other areas, this seems to be something that is new for IF Charities, this idea of building skills and getting kids ready at a younger age, 6 to 13, to get ready for possible opportunities for economic development in their futures.
Absolutely. And I think, our focus wanted to be really about solving issues and being a part of the solution to making our community stronger. And when you looked at everything that everyone's going through, and the world's changed, you can't necessarily graduate from high school, go to college, get a degree, and walk out of that and have a job. With that change, when we looked at what are things that we really believe that will be there in the future and opportunities that will provide and position these kids for opportunities to provide for themselves and their families, coding really stood out as one of those things. One of the companies that that supported us in the campaign, has gone from, 30 employees to thousands of employees, and they're hiring developers and engineers consistently. And those companies will start to see more of those coming online and in our world, it's really about just trying to be a part of the solution. And help the community.
When you choose for IF Charities and choose what you're going to put resources to, talk about that process. When you get your crew together to think about what might help Chicago kids, put us in the boardroom with you to figure out how you choose what IF Charities is going to be involved in.
Well, we've recently, with the repositioning of focusing on kind of that IF as a part of our brand, imagine if we focus on solution, imagine if we come together, what the outcome might be in the future. We'll continue to do the things that we've done in the past. Originally, we did the All-Star Football Camp. We'll continue to do that, helping kids understand that, during the summer, they have to make the right decisions. The Shop with a Cop program, the holidays we just passed, we had 130 kids. It was amazing. We had 40 police officers and just like letting the kids know they're not alone in whatever they're going through. And there's a real support from the law enforcement and from members in the community for them. So we're doing all these things that are really social and emotional based, and helping the kids understand who they are, how they fit, and putting a plan together for their lives. We wanted to now add something that was a real direct line programmatically that we could, give the kids this. And at the end of the day, they would have a skill set that would position them for, that other thing. And, after being involved in a bunch of tech companies, you look at everything going on with like the blockchain and cryptocurrencies in the world. It's being able to code and speak the language of technology and all of these different types of technologies. It's going to be a huge part of our future world. And I think a real opportunity for some of these communities that might be challenged, if we're able to go in there and provide this skill set at no cost to the kids, they will be better off.
What's the challenge? I mean, what's the biggest challenge when you're running a charity like that and you want to make a transition and go to rebrand as IF as opposed to the Israel Adonijay Foundation? But also, you know, you, as you mentioned, you had the football camp and people understand that and they want to be a part of the camp because of your time here in Chicago as an athlete. What are the challenges of offering up these programs like the IF Code that are out of the realm of what we know Israel Adonijay for?
Well, I think the challenges are, or when you look at kind of the camps and the shop with the cop, those programs are hard to scale. You know, and you look at any business, scalability is like a real important piece of why you get in the business to begin with. When we look at IF Code, you know, our first goal is we're going to teach and give this skill set to 2,000 kids. We're going to start really, you know, another challenge is making sure that experience is a one where we can measure the wins for the kids along the way. So we get a young kid that's 11, 12, 13. They come into the program. They have no idea about coding or something that they could do. Like, that experience is really important. So, you know, we're just starting with our first class of kids. We're going to put them through that. We're going to make sure it's an incredible experience. We're going to tweak it and continue to grow the class size. And just, I think the biggest challenge in all of that is just making sure that the experience from the first kid in to that last, till their graduation, is one where we can measure those wins, mm-hmm. and that the children at the completion of the program really feel empowered, and we all can high five and say, wow, that was an incredible experience, and now let's focus on doing that with 5,000 kids, 10,000 kids, an entire community. And that's the real focus of that's the real important part that we've got to get that right as a team.
Israel Adonijay, my guest, of course, the former Chicago Bear and serial entrepreneur. IF Charities, putting on the IF Code. You can find out the information about the program, which is coming up here in February at ifcharities.org. You know, making that transition, listening to some of the stuff you just mentioned about the charity, whether it be scalability or measurement or data about whether or not the kids are getting what they need to get out of it. How much of your experience from working in the private sector and working as an entrepreneur do you rely on when dealing with your charity?
I mean, I think, you know, all lessons are kind of compounding, and the things that you've had successes in, you carry those into the next endeavor. And the things that you've struggled in, you try to learn the lessons out of those and carry that into the next endeavor. So that's why we bring on a team like Codeverse and Katie and in what they're doing to really streamline the process of making coding something that everyone can do. I've never written a line of code in my life. You know, I went down, I spent some time with them. I wrote my first line of code. I was able to like animate some interactions on this, on the digital side of the screen. So personally kind of going through it. So learning that at the end of the day, in all things, you want to make sure the team itself is right. And I think I also learned that through my years in sport and with the Bears and playing. You have to have the right people on the team that have their own playbook for success and have things that they've already experienced. They've been through the journey partially. So you're coming, when you plug them in, they accelerate your learning curve. They accelerate your ability to execute the game plan. They bring some domain knowledge to what you're already trying to do. So those are the types of things that we're applying to IF Code specifically. And as you know, the team is everything. And then even more importantly is the execution of the plan, you know, which I think is what I alluded to earlier, being able to make sure we get that right.
You know, I always wonder about, as an entrepreneur and all the, you have such a diverse and distinct background when you talk about the things that you've invested in or been involved in as an entrepreneur. How do you go about choosing a project to get involved in, whether it be something that's more in a manufacturing sector or something that might be tech based? When you're evaluating what you want to do next as an entrepreneur, what goes into that decision?
Well, if I were to ask my manager and kind of my team, they would say, Izzy, let's not do another thing. Let's not do anything else. You know, we have a full plate. But I think for me, kind of the barometer is, you know, something that I'm excited about. So there's definitely, whether I know about the industry or not, like listening to it or getting it, you know, learning about it, you know, it's for me personally, it excites me. I like to be involved in things that have a global approach that could be implemented anywhere in the world outside of just kind of our neighborhood or our community. I think it's important that the industry or the company is focused on innovation. You know, what is the pivot that you're able to do that really differentiates and separates you from anyone else? And then I think also companies that are really, really focused on service or corporate social responsibility is a part of the essence of the company. And then there's the team. Again, the team, yeah. the people behind it. And, you know, in any endeavor, it will not be easy. What you thought was going to happen will not happen, and it'll be the opposite. And having, like, the right people that, like, are good people at the end of the day on board, you know, those are some of the keys that actually help you, like, make it through those storms that every entrepreneur will have.
I have a lot of different, you know, business people and entrepreneurs that come through on the Download in Chicago Business. And one of the questions that I always ask is about how they deal with risk and the concept of failure. And whether yeah. or not, you know, when to walk away from a company. I mean, if you had to, in your career, I think about all the lessons that you learned on the football field, but also in being an entrepreneur, a serial entrepreneur who continues to come up with new projects and invest in new things. How important is risk and failure in the work that you do?
I mean, it's critical. I mean, I'm fortunate to have had some wins. You know, but I've also had a lot of losses and a lot of tough lessons. I've taken the short end of the stick due to lack of due diligence and lack of, like, really knowing the space before entering it. So I've learned all these things. I've been a part of some deals that have just not gone as planned. And you know, those tough lessons are all, I think, a really important part of the journey and an important part of any entrepreneur. I mean, anyone who's had any type of success will, I'm sure, has experienced a lot of failures and challenges also, you know, and I really, especially even speaking to athletes, you yeah. know, for us, you know, we've done so much ourselves with our physical bodies and our ability to, like, wheel our way to, you know, get the tryout, to make the team, to, like, beat the guy across from us. So many of us jump into business post-career and, you know, we think we'll be able to use that brute force to now just start that next thing. And the truth is, you know, before you ever made a check in playing football, you know, you put in years, 5 years collegiately, you put in, like, all these years, high school, you put in all these years of preparation before you ever monetized that business. Although that business was your body, and we have to take, not just athletes, but anyone, you have to take that same approach to any business. You have to understand that, like, you got to put in the years, you got to put in the time, you've got to do the work, do the diligence, pay the price, you know, understand, you know, all the nuances. And, you know, they say typically it's 5 years, you know, 5 years after or X amount of years after, you know, if you're fortunate to be one of those companies that is able to make it and to grow and to scale and to become a big thing, you know, yeah. You know, it's special, you know, but, you know, there's no magical wand or there's no magical formula, to starting or growing a business, whether it's, you know, post transition or whether it's just somebody at home with a great idea.
Yeah, and it's we talked about this last time you were in too, just about the lessons learned from playing sports and also being a professional athlete. And I would think a lot of that obviously relates to starting your own business and continuing to thrive in your own business. Israel Adonijé, my guest, of course, the former Chicago Bear, who is the man behind several different companies, including IF Charities. IF Code is going to be coming out in February. You can find out more information at ifcharities.org about that. Before I let you go, Israel, obviously this week, big news for your former teammate, Brian Urlacher, who is a first ballot, is a finalist for the first ballot for the Hall of Fame. What's it mean? Yeah. And you know, what's your reaction to that Urlacher is on the ballot?
Oh my God. It's extremely exciting. I mean, to have played with Brian all the years, that I was fortunate to be a part of the defense when his leadership was in place was incredible. We had a lot of fun together, and you know, there's no doubt about it that you know that he's one of those guys that should be a first ballot Hall of Famer for everything that he's represented to the game. I think how he's carried himself as a professional, his leadership, really about team and his teammates first. And it's just, you couldn't be happier to you know, for him and for his family to for him to get that recognition. So I'm excited. I'm excited for him. You know, we all every once in a while get on group chats and talk and text. So we're all standing by, and everybody's really, really excited and hoping that you know, what we expect to happen happens.
Yeah, no, Chicago feels the same way. Israel Adonijé, If Charities, you can find all the information at ifcharities.org. My guest in the Download in Chicago Business. Israel, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Hey, thank you. Take care. Happy New Year.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. Thanks, Rob. All right. We got a big show tonight. Adam Hogue coming up at 9 o'clock. We'll talk about what the Bears are going to do with their head coaching search. And also, beyond that, I mean, because that's a big story. And I want to talk about that because that's important. But there are a lot of other things that need to be fixed with the Chicago Bears and what we saw. And as the pursuit of finding a new coach is underway, what else do we have to be thinking about as fans? How close are the Chicago Bears to being a playoff contender? We'll talk about that coming up at 9 o'clock hour. And, of course, Greg Flamm of the Swap Meet moving to Thursday night. He's on tonight, 10 o'clock, 312-981-7200. One of my favorite segments, Wednesday night staple, has now a Thursday night dynamo. It hasn't even started yet, and I'm calling it a dynamo. And I just think of all the Thursday night listeners who have been deprived of this Wednesday night fun. And now you can have it. The Wednesday night fans still just come, they just stay. Good 24 hours, and they're back for the Thursday night thing. So, well, it's time for another visit from our resident philosopher, Professor Al Genie. He joins us from time to time to talk about the big picture. Last time we talked about how the pursuit of happiness is actually making us unhappy. See the news today about social media doing the exact same thing. And before that, we talked about the seven deadly sins and how to balance those sins versus the lives we actually have to live. You can find out those conversations all at our website, WGNradio.com. You can search Al Genie. Tonight, let's talk satire. This past year was ripe for political satire, as we saw some performers excel at pointing out the foibles of the Trump administration. But we also saw backlash as more and more comedians turned into political commentators to take umbrage to some of the things that are happening in this political climate. But as many categorize comedy and satire into partisan politics, Al does the work. And he looks back throughout human history to see how this comedic tool has served societies as far back as the Egyptians and the pyramids. The point being, speaking truth to power, it's not a modern world invention. Professor Al Genie back with us tonight. He's a professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University Chicago and the recent author of The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives, our resident philosopher, Al Genie. Happy New Year. Good to
Wonderful
see you,
Wonderful to see you again. It's hard to believe it's 2018. Can I tell my yearly January 1st story? In 1949, I was in first grade, and the good nuns were teaching us, and even though we couldn't read and write, they taught us to block out our names, so every paper had to put Alfred R. Genie, then JMJ, those of you who are not Catholic, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph in capital letters, and then the date. So, September 28th, 1949. So, anyway, so the school year, Christmas comes up, we come back, it's in January, and now it's 1950. But I could not wrap my head around the concept. So I put down January 4th, 1949 plus one, and the nun beat the hell out of me for being impudent. How I ever became a teacher, I don't know.
You learned that's the first lesson.
And that's not a joke, but that is sarcasm about the nuns. And that's a good way to begin.
It's a good way to begin.
Let's talk.
Because I've always been someone who's done political satire, and I've always had a problem with how to categorize comedy.
Yeah.
Because there are jokes, there's satire, there's political satire, there's sarcasm. Talk about the differences between these categories.
And I think there is a real difference. I think when you talk about joke telling, we're talking about entertainment. It's called show business. And, you know, even before you started to think about comedy, there were people who came out there and told jokes. Good morning, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, did you hear the one about? They came out there, the Myron Cohens of the world, you know, the Jackie Gleasons of the world, these stand-up comics. By the way, stand-up comedy invented in this country by comedians. Jerry Lewis was not a stand-up comic, for example. We think of him as a great comedian, but he was not a stand-up comic. But we're talking about a show business. They had tuxedos on. They told lovely stories. They went from story to story to story to story. And it was charming, and you paid so much dollars, et cetera, et cetera. They're joke tellers. They're out there. Maybe they said something profound indirectly, but the real attempt is to make us laugh.
Yeah.
It was a diversion. It was lovely. Now, sarcasm is something different. Sarcasm is something used in our lives all the time. Something ironic or bitter or caustic that we say about somebody. Something that's, you know, cutting or a put down.
The eye roll.
Yeah, to irate you. It's like one of my favorite comments is, I like being single. This way you can pick out the woman who abuses you. You can regularly pick out the woman who abuses you. Something, you know, something that's really snarky. But and so that's really sarcasm. But to me, the real issue, satire. Satire is an entirely different thing. It's comedy with an edge. Comedy that is more than just being comedic. It's making a comment about society or politics. You know, Robin Williams once said that the purpose of satire is to show that the Pope can farts as well. But that's only a little piece of it. That's, you know, kind of,
yeah.
I think in some sense, satire is this attempt to expose, to critique, unveil, to disassemble something in society and to make fun of it, to look at it in another way. The Greek word, it means to tear one's flesh, to bite one's lip in anger about something. And so I think satire is poking fun at things, to examine them, to disassemble them, to kind of be iconoclastic, to deconstruct it, to detox it, to look at for what it really is. So when he was talking about, when Robin Williams went to prove that the Pope farts as well, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, I just got off a plane and it sounds like it right now.
No, it's good. But
the reality is, I think satire is an attempt to not just tell the jokes, but to preach, to rant,
yeah,
to examine, to look at the underpinnings, if you will. Where there's a similarity between comedy, just straight entertainment, and satire is that comics and satirists are canaries in the coal mine. They are bespeaking something that's going,
you know,
on. They're bringing something to our attention.
I love this topic because satire, when you talk about comedy with an edge,
yeah,
it's not just satirists that do it. Meaning it's become a format. And
yeah,
you've had so many. I think that's part of the reasons that it falls into partisan politics, is because there's a lot of comics who didn't necessarily, weren't comics with an edge, that have found a niche,
yeah,
in making fun of Trump or making fun of whatever. And they just go, I think of late night talk shows. But then there are people that you believe have an axe to grind, or that they're angry, or that they have the edge. And I think of people like Stephen Colbert, who approved it, and you feel that organic nature when he's doing the Colbert Report and he's making fun of Bill O'Reilly. And then you see in what he does every night on The Late Show, where you feel that he wants to say something about Trump. This is his duty, and it's,
yeah,
part of who he is. He's not just faking it.
But this is the new. I mean, let's distinguish American political satire in different ways. This is the new satire. I think if we want to look at the icons of satire in America, we have to look at Mark Twain. I think we have to look at the singing cowboy. I'm sorry, the philosophical cowboy. And I'm blanking on his name right now. You're going to think of it for me.
No,
right?
I know.
Will Rogers. There,
yeah,
we
right.
go.
Sorry.
Will Rogers. I'm sorry. And Mort Saul. And in some sense, Mark Twain, as Hemingway said, without Mark Twain, there would be no literature in America. There would be no literary commentary in America. Mark Twain uses pulpit as a novelist and as an essayist to make comments about reality. He says, ladies and gentlemen, let's pretend this is a society of rational people and that things really work well. Oh, we can't do that. There is a Congress. Boom. He made comments about society. He used his comedy to analyze, to dissect, to take apart issues. And he did it very consciously. And as a later performer in the world, he did it in a way that stepped away from his literature, that he went around and gave talks.
Yeah.
And that it became, in some sense, America's first stand-up. And then Will Rogers comes along in the 30s. People are falling apart. He comes out there and says, you know, the only thing I know is what I read in the papers every day, and then made comments about this. He started off as a cowboy rodeo star, went into burlesque, did Ziegfeld Follies, and then...
Which is why you could see the success of Will Rogers, or success of Mark Twain,
yeah, yeah,
or anywhere along the line. You can understand why it has been compartmentalized and made into a format.
Right, right.
That's a form. I mean, right. I think of the early days of even the Tonight Show or some of the, that's where the daily monologue comes from.
Right, the daily monologue came from. In fact, you know, the wonderful thing about those shows before, let's say, everything changes with Bill Murray.
Bill Maher. Yeah.
Bill Maher and the show at night. Excuse me, I'm having a really hard
politically
time.
Incorrect.
Politically incorrect right? stuff.
The show he had on Comedy Central incorrect. That went to
and it all starts with them. Things begin to change, and then these satirists, including John
Stewart,
begins to change the nature of what we mean by political commentary and what we mean by satire. And they created that. There wasn't fake news; it was fake commentary. And that's different from what was happening with Mort Saul, who's really the transitional figure. Mort Saul comes in and walks out on stage looking like a college
professor. He's himself, right.
Yeah, he's himself
right.
with the New York Times
right.
under his...
he's got something to say. He's going to be poetic
He's going to say this. So he started to do stand-up, but with a purpose. You know,
right.
one of his classic lines is, "Of course I believe in execution. If you don't kill people, how are they ever going to learn?" And he did that kind of stuff.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But he then became very, very political and only political. By the way, he's 93 and he still performs one night a week in California doing that kind of stuff. But real satire, the satire as we know it now, has evolved in the last 25 years.
Do you think that that's good or bad? That's what I'm trying to get, because I listened to Stephen Colbert. Roe was playing some stuff in the top five at five about his... Which was a really funny joke where the president said he's going to have the fake news awards
right.
coming up, which I think is hilarious. That's a whole other thing where what happens when the satire is coming from the source.
Right.
But you know, he says, and Stephen Colbert's response was, "For your consideration." He put up billboards in Times Square that were mocking the idea of what people do to get a Golden
right.
Globe or an Emmy or an Oscar.
Right.
And the categories are really funny. And I was like, that's a really, regardless of politics,
right.
that to me is baseline eat your vegetables satire, political
right.
satire. He nailed it.
And it's social satire as well. Now, you got to remember, you started to say the night shows, Johnny Carson's Award.
Yeah.
They told a political joke or two. Even Saturday Night Live, they always did something that was political, but it was one-off.
Not
a political show. Yes, since day one, they had one of the characters making fun of the president, right? So
right.
who started off doing Jerry Ford. Chevy Chase,
yeah.
all the way down now to an award-winning, Trump. But satire began to become totally political with Jon Stewart and Bill Maher.
Al Jeanney, my guest, the resident philosopher here for The Download. We're talking about the history of political satire, how it's changed over the years. And when we come back, let's talk about the history going
yeah.
back, because we just talked about American political satire. But what I find to be fascinating is that this form, before Mark Twain didn't invent it,
right.
it has moved from generation to generation, from ancestors to ancestors. You can date it all the way back to the jesters and dynasties, and of course, the pyramids and the Egyptians. So we'll talk more about political satire with a resident philosopher, Professor Al Jeanney, here on The Download. Stay with us. Here's a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. My guest in studio for the 8 o'clock hour at the big table, Professor Al Jeanney, our resident philosopher and the professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago, and the author of the new book, The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. Tonight, we do this with you from time to time, where we just kind of bring it down to once a month, it feels
yeah,
like.
At least a month.
But we talk about the bigger picture things and kind of get into what's happening. And I feel like political satire is a great place to be and to talk about and to explore and be philosophical about, because it almost feels like, and we see it from this president, that if you speak out in this way, it's
right.
it's shame or it's treason or it's unpatriotic. And we've seen this. And in your work and in the book and other places, you see that this is something that even some of the big, powerful people in human history have desired to be next to them.
Designed to be next to it, but I think you have to remember something here. This president, whatever your political background here, I'm trying to be as objective as possible. This president is simply a magnet for satirical analysis. Come on. His demeanor, his verbiage, his style, everything about him in some sense is drawing attention. Now, anybody in that office, and I've been spending this last couple of years reading every presidential biography of every president, which is absolutely fascinating. Everyone in that office is reviled, made fun of. You can see the whole history of it. You don't think Washington was loved, but they still made fun of him. Jefferson, they made look like a buffoon. They always had him in slippers someplace because he was trying to become. What they did to poor Mr. Lincoln is beyond comprehension. Drawing him as a gorilla. Literally drawing the old Sun-Times, the predecessor of the Sun-Times, the guy called him, you know, so many stupid things, it was beyond comprehension. So that was also vicious. But I think Mr. Trump has generated, has created an engine that has generated more satire than before, simply because he's so audacious. He's so irreverent. He's so unusual. His methodology and demeanor just asks for that
and
kind of
political
analysis.
Satirists love thin-skinned politicians.
Absolutely.
And this is one who he likes to push back, he likes to fight back, and it gives more
of
fuel
course.
To the comedians.
I mean, absolutely. And we off mic, we're talking about Mr. Obama. Well, Mr. Obama didn't fight back. Mr. Obama joined the crowd. Mr. Obama, to my interpretation is, he understood the power of humor. When he went out to California to be with Marin, when he took some, with the Fern Room, et cetera, these smaller shows, these podcasts, he knew exactly what he was doing. First of all, he understood the media. He understood that this wonderful electronic system that we have in front of us has all kinds of other opportunities besides WGN and the major stations. So he knew how to get to the younger people. I find it fascinating that my daughter's generation listens to me on this show, but not while we're on. Later they pick it up later in a different way. So he understood that, and he wanted to get out there and give a message, but that meant
this
being
is not
to be laughed at.
But I was just going to say, Al, this is not a segment about the legacy of President Obama.
No.
It's a segment about political satire.
Right.
And I would make an argument, and it's not a popular one, that the political satirists fell down on the job with President Obama. As you talked about, I mean, some of the more legendary presidents of our time, Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, they were, you know, they had the same kind of press and cartoons and other things about them, and they were making fun of the power. But Obama, and maybe it was the first African-American president, whatever it might be, he was a liberal, and most of the comics seemed to be coming from a liberal bend.
Yeah.
There seemed to be more satire that was done about Washington or about the issues of the day,
agree.
And less about the
but
president.
I think he disarmed them by playing with them. And
it's
you start telling jokes, he's very, very savvy. So I think that, but there's a long history here, you're quite right, of satire. You know, going back, Jonathan Swift, of course, in the English tradition, this brilliant, you know, when he said, you know, when their great genius appears, the world will know, you will know them by the sign that the Confederacy of Dunces will gather around them. This notion of using language to disarm and to kind of dissect something. One of my favorite quotes is the Clarence Darrow quote, "When I was a boy, I was told anyone could become president, and now I'm beginning to believe it." He's talking about Harding and so on and so forth. And it's absolutely true, these wonderful statements. But you got to remember what it's about. I know in the book I tried to write a funny line that I'm sure that comedy and satire probably started at the same time. So when some unknown Egyptian made a joke about the changing depth of the Nile and the peculiar shape of the pyramids, they then took a cheap shot at the Pharaoh's mummy. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
But there is something to be said that this is the whole concept of the jester,
right?
And the concept in human history of how political satire has played out. It has always been pretty close and a tool that's been used by
absolutely.
The populace to take truth to power.
And in every society, a wonderful book by Beatrice Otto called the Jesters, a beautiful book that every society, not just Europe, not just the English court, had jesters that had the power to speak truth to power, but only as jesters. Only in, you know, why do they wear uniforms? Because it was a job. You had to know it. You had to be within that. You had to do this role. They also knew that they had to do it in a funny way. They couldn't just say, "Your Majesty, let me critique your last three proposals," so on and so forth. But rather, he had to do it with a joke involved, so on and so forth. And by the way, because there are very few women, even the Cheyennes had contraries that were allowed to say that. And it's a release valve in a society. I think satirists, I think comics
are the contraries.
Are the contraries that allow us to examine issues and disrobe issues and be vicious about issues without going to war about it. But it forces an analysis of that. Even a cruel Trump joke. There's so many Trump jokes, it's not worth doing. This whole industry has been created by that because, as Lewis Black has said, who's been a satirist for 35 years and made fun of everybody, including the people he loved, including Mr. Obama, love Mr. Obama, but I've seen him do 3 hours on ripping him apart satirically. There's a whole industry created right now. Why are these people, the five major shows now at night, are all talking about Trump? Why? Because he's offering, as Lewis Black said, it's almost not being fun being a comic anymore because I don't have to write. I just have to read the paper. You know, I just right. have to get up and say, well, what's happened today? But what they're really doing is using the real world as a place to examine the ideal world or the better world.
You know, you mentioned with Lincoln.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of physical jokes that were made about
it. Oh, my God.
That became the thing. And I think about Ronald Reagan as another example. Saturday Night Live did the piece with, I think it was Phil Hartman.
Oh, God,
who would act like he was dumb. And then when they closed the door, he was, like, on it. George W. Bush got Saturday Night Live and everyone in between just portrayed him as a buffoon. Bill Clinton, to a certain extent, got the same thing about with satirists making fun of him. And in Trump, you see the same thing again. The danger, and we'll talk about this after the news as well. But the danger in Trump's hair is funny. I can't believe the funny things he says or the way he acts is that you're not paying attention to the actual job of being truth to power. You're not talking about the things that might be the policies that are changing in this country or the way that we live or things that might be unfair because satirists are spending too much time messing around with the superficial.
There's what do you mean by a satirist? I think there are superficial satirists and serious systemic satirists who are trying to make Mort Saul is really trying to make
I'm just talking about the contraries. Yeah, Mort Saul is a contrary. He's
a real contrary.
Right.
But, you know, these cheap shots, cheap jokes are right. still satire, so you have to be the judge of it. Come on, you've been in the comic business for a long time. There are good comics and bad comics. I mean, how do you evaluate them? But I really think what we're talking about here is satire is about critique. But remember, critique isn't always put down. Critique is about taking something apart, examining it, so maybe you can put it back together again. I think the Jonathan Swifts of the world are trying to correct the world, not simply comment on the world.
You know, we'll take a break here because I want to get to tonight's news, but a great picking up point coming up after Rob's news. You're seeing more and more, and I think this is where this fake news concept comes from. This is where you get a groundswell of people that are upset with a liberal agenda, if you will, and being contrary, is this idea that, I don't know, that we're not necessarily, I'm trying to think the best way to say this, if that the idea that, we're running out of time, but I want to get to the idea that we maybe... satire has changed, as you mentioned, with Colbert and everything that's happening, to a point that we're no longer the satire and the actual points that we're going after are not the right things. They're not that CNN or MSNBC or NBC. They're using satire when they shouldn't be. Right?
It's not enough to make fun of his hair. That real satire is making fun of his policy.
But my point being that like we're seeing more and more news organizations using satire, rolling their eyes, doing things that have been done for the comics in uniform.
Right.
As you talked about, the jesters were in uniform. You knew they were the jesters. Now it's getting all discombobulated on Twitter and social media and other places where you're not sure, why is the anchor that is telling me the news is also rolling his eyes at what's being said? That's the part I want to get to.
Okay.
We come back. Al Genie, our resident philosopher and the professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at the University of Loyola Chicago. We'll talk more about political satire coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, our resident philosopher, Al Genie. He's a professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago. He's also the author of The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. And we're talking about funny tonight. We're talking about political satire. Well, an area of comedy that we have seen explode in ways that I don't know if we would have thought in starting 2018 because of the Trump administration. But we have seen a backlash, if you will. A lot of people who might be conservative, who are sick and tired of mainstream talk shows and other places continuing to make these jokes about their president or president. They feel like, I get this a lot on the show when we start to debate about President Trump. They say, hey, have respect for the
The office.
So for the office.
But again, I want to point out to you that the reason there's so many jokes about this is because the man engenders it. And I think we're forgetting something really basic. Satire, again, is not just regular comedy. You know, the priest, a rabbi, and a monk walk into a bar, and the bartender says, hey, is this a joke? Boom, ba boom, boom. That's pretty good. But satire is kind of a caustic, a comic criticism of the cosmos. And I think real satirists, like on The Onion, for example, serious satirists are trying to criticize by ripping apart something, going back to the Greek etymology of the word, to really disembowel it to understand it. Now, not necessarily to destroy it, but to understand it. Now, we've talked about this before. I think one of the things that comedy does for us is it disarms, it lets us cope better, it lets us tolerate things better, gives us a reprieve from it. But satire says, no, let's look at this right in the face. And the best example of that is the Bill Maher show. I think Bill Maher, 25 years on the air, and Jon Stewart changed comedy, as I said before, changed satire, as I said before. But Maher's show now, to me, is an amazing. He gets up there, he rants, he raves, he shows all of his own personal political predilections. He makes fun of everyone there. The panel he puts up there of other geniuses, he puts down, so on and so forth. He's out there to make a point. People, 4.5 million people watch that show every week. They want to hear that. He is being a funny analyst of society. And I think that's what satire really is. And what we have is, yes, I think in some sense, Stephen Courbet, who came out of, think of the tree that comes out of Jon Stewart's shows. When he played before the conservative, the Colbert show, he was actually playing the conservative, but in the irony was he was playing the conservative to make another point. Now he's the pope of liberalism there, the closer to his own political points of view, because he can be. Why does he keep doing it every night? Because it's there. It's comic fodder. How can you not?
And people seem to want it.
And people seem to, it's the release valve.
Okay, but here's a question. I don't know if we have the answer here, but I do see with the naked eye that the political satirists of our time, the ones that you just mentioned, Bill Maher, Stephen Colbert, Jon Stewart, they all have a liberal bent.
Yep.
Even when Obama was president, and I'll give Jon Stewart credit because I think that he did go after Obama enough on that show, but a lot of times it was about Congress, it was about John Boehner, it was about the Republican Senate. There are a lot of different things. But it always seems to fall, political satire, at least in entertainment in Hollywood and places that are on television and other parts of media seem to come from a liberal place. Why is that? I don't understand why there isn't a fleet of conservative comics that are also being trotted out on a Tuesday night at 10:30.
Well, there's not a fleet of them. There certainly are enough out there if you go to enough of those small clubs. And we're talking about off mic the gentleman before from Saturday Night Live.
Dennis Miller. That's not a comparison. That's a 1990 comparison.
Well, you know what? But you know why he's not successful? Because he's not that funny. Because he's got fewer targets. I think you have to talk about targets. These fools that worked in courts died unless there was something to make fun of. Now, they made fun of Milady's hairstyle today or something like that. That was irrelevant. They were supposed to make fun of real issues. Like it or not, this guy is a whirlwind of material for anyone. Who do you talk about?
I agree wholeheartedly. It's easy, and it's also important to truth to power to this current administration. But I would make the argument that the candidate that he beat, Hillary Clinton,
is
someone that you will go on to social media, and if you find yourself in conservative circles, there are a lot of memes, a lot of jokes, a lot of things going on. So I just don't understand why that hasn't bubbled up to the mainstream. That's my point.
Well, because we're actually tired of it. She's not as funny as he is, in some sense, she's being ripped apart by Democrats.
But the
conservatives are doing that as well, and she's got a lot there. I mean, there's a lot, as Churchill said, there's a lot less there than meets the eye, and therefore she can be taken apart. But when you've got this outrageous character standing in the middle of the room, how do you not do it? That's still the job. And they haven't run out of materials.
Yeah.
I mean, if he would, for example, this is his genius in some sense. He starts twittering. If he twitters out on a given morning, Tweedledee, Tweedledum, the headline in the New York Times is, Tweedledee, Tweedledum, what does the president mean by that, right? He controls the media. Well, his persona controls your comic fodder.
Let me ask this, and this is something that, you know, is just kind of curious about this. Is Donald Trump, not the president, but the man, is he a political satirist in the way that he would go in these campaign rallies and places with thousands of people in the room, and he would make jokes about the health care, and he'd make jokes about Obama, and he would do truth to power, and people get riled up, and it would be taken out by the news organizations, say, can you believe he said this? But he is making jokes.
Not only did he make comments like that, and you know this, for 5 years before he ran for the presidency, he was on all the major comedy shows.
Doing bits. Yeah.
And doing bits on his own show. This is the first television persona that's become president of the United States.
But I mean, but I think that he does political satire.
Satire, right? It's not only held by Stephen Courbet. Satire is when, again, you analyze, take something apart, make fun of, belittle, to try to understand it or try to destroy it. Now,
I love you. I love you, Al. I love when you're like Stephen Courbet.
Did I say Courbet?
Yeah, I love it. Sorry. I love it. I just love it. I love it.
I mispronounce
I know,
so
it's
many
not a
words.
Big deal. I just think it's like, but I wonder about it. I just wonder about as we continue as news organizations,
yeah,
to cover the president in certain ways, and it continues to take this tone of, I can't believe he said that. I mean, even yesterday, and I know that he's not, I mean, this is the strange part of our world right now, that jesters and political satirists' job is to get truth to power, but what happens when the jester and the political satirist becomes the power? Because the tweet on Kim Jong-un, where he says, I too have a nuclear button, and it's right, bigger, and it's more powerful, right, and mine works. That's a comment. That's political satire.
That's right.
He just did it in form. So I guess that's what I think. Why our heads are exploding?
No, as a satirist might say, or utter stupidity and juvenilia. And so you make
maybe he's bad at it. But the point being,
right,
he's
no,
trying.
I agree with you. But I think, you know, I'm going to go all the way back to Will Rogers when he said most people are actors on stage. They have writers. Bob Hope. You know, when we talk about show business, Bob Hope never created a joke in his life. He had drawers and drawers and drawers of jokes. He had 20 people writing for him constantly, and he just got up there and he delivered, right? Rogers says, I don't. I just get up there and I get the material from Congress. All I have to do is look at the political page.
Right.
And so I think what's happening, there's nothing new here. He's just the 600-pound gorilla in charge.
Yeah.
I don't think satire has been ruined by him. I don't think satire is only about him, but he's unavoidable. Come on. If you were working Zanies right now for a living and going around, how do you not use some of that material? How
well,
do you
I just,
not
I just
analyze?
Wonder there's danger in it in
there
the sense that,
in
that he becomes both. He
right.
becomes the power and speaks to power, and then the actual political satirists lose their voice in the sense that they don't know exactly
where
to plant their flag.
And yet, I want to make this is the important point I think we should make right now. Peter Sagal, our friend Peter Sagal.
Wait, don't tell me. Just celebrated 20 years,
just,
right?
Just celebrated that. And interesting, it's a real news show that makes fun of mm-hmm. you know that makes fun of others. I think it's fascinating when he talks about that the new media gets it. That, you know, one out of five people under 35 get all their information from these shows. And they get it, that there's a double entendre happening right now. I think I pronounced that correctly, by the way, but you might want to check your fucking wagon
right,
on it.
Right. I know.
There's a double entendre going on right now. They get that there's a comic bit going on, but at the same time, that comic bit is taking on all these little facts, okay? So they can distinguish between here's the joke, and here's the facts.
Yeah.
Well, now they're doing these studies. These people are better informed than NPR listeners, CNN listeners, and Fox listeners, because they're making a distinction. Now, the new chap, the Pakistani young man, whose name I'm
Aziz Ansari.
Yes.
Or commit.
No,
yeah. No,
no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, yes.
Aziz Ansari is an Indian.
Hassan
Minaj.
Minaj.
Yeah.
Minaj.
Yeah.
He's Pakistani. I thought he's Pakistani.
Yeah.
And he said it. He says, this is the new media now. He says, these shows, which I thought I was just being a comic on, I realize I'm dispensing information. And this is the current equivalent of journalism.
But I just find that to be dangerous.
It is dangerous,
right?
When you don't get enough correct facts.
But what's more important? I guess the point is when Hassan Minaj, who's been on this program and a great comic, and he has that to say, and I think he's correct in saying so. But the danger is, hey, you know, at a certain point, people are going to say that's what I learned my information
right.
from, or that's what I gleaned from this world by what the
judge.
And
totally
the question I have from when you talk about from an editorial standpoint
right.
is what's more important to The Daily Show? What's more important, the facts or the joke?
Yeah, that's really a tough one. And listen, as a professor, when somebody says, where'd you get that fact? Oh, Wikipedia. Great. Thank you. It doesn't work. Or for my generation, it was the Monarch Notes. You know, I didn't read the book.
Cliff Notes, right?
Which, by the way, used to be wonderful, but now, you know.
Like, you can't do that anymore.
You can't do that anymore.
Ruined Cliff Notes.
Well, I think that the reality is that you got to make a distinction between those two. I think that what John Stewart did, and it was brilliant, as Oliver points out, it says, this is not fake news. This is real news that I'm dissecting and making fun of and belittling.
Right.
In fact, it's a little difficult to watch the Oliver show. He's so professorial. He's so a machine gun in his analysis that, boy, you have to really pay attention. But in that critique is both humor and wisdom, and it's profound.
When you talk about the names that you're throwing around, John Oliver, Stephen Colbert, Hasan Minhaj, and down the line, are we living in a golden age of political satire?
Yeah,
what about George Carlin?
Right.
That was social and political
satire.
Social,
political.
You think of the late 60s, you think of all those great comedians, think of Saturday Night Live in the mid-70s.
Absolutely.
But are we right now living in what you would call the golden age of political satire?
And you know, if I was going to add one other person to that that triumph, I would put George Carlin right in there, because he did both. In fact, he did social commentary and then political commentary, and he got better and better and better. And interestingly enough, he started off in a tuxedo telling jokes on stage, right, and moved all the way across the board to this, in the end, you know, this great comic. I do think we are in a golden age. I mean, let's not forget Samantha Bee is another graduate of that show. And so we've created this new engine of productivity. By the way, Jon Stewart, they loved him and they praised him. I'm sure you saw the end of the show, too. He was also draconian with them. He worked them to death. One of the reasons he quit is he couldn't take his own pace. He couldn't take the workload after 16 years. Do you see how he looks right now? Either he's taking the worst possible drugs or that man is really
let me bring back the point I made right before we went to the news, that one of the issues that seems to be an outgrowth of what's happening with political satire is that people recognize it's popular.
Yeah.
And in doing so, whether you're at organizations like CNN or NBC or CBS or ABC or Fox down the line, they're finding ways to incorporate that.
Right.
And when that could be through an eye roll, it could be through joking with other panelists on the and finding ways to make it less about news and more about analyzing the news and, in a sense, having political satire. And that seems to be the outgrowth of where this, quote, hashtag fake news outgrowth comes from. Is that not happened before? I mean, is this a new phenomenon?
No, this is a coming together of three things. The number of comics out there, the media that's changed, and so many
different platforms have changed,
so many outfits, and the players. Eisenhower jokes were about golf. Or the Eisenhower dollars, you wound it up and it walked in the corner and did nothing. I remember that joke, you know. and the Kennedy jokes, you know, and so on and so forth. You know, there was a comic who, I can't think of his name right now, he did the Kennedy album, and he never did any other thing. He sold millions and millions of copies of the albums. Every president has had their critique. And Will Rogers made fun of FDR like crazy. FDR invited him to the White House regularly to talk about some of these things because he felt Will Rogers had captured the tempo. So it's the performers, it is the medium, and it is the issues involved. And right now, the glorious issue, like it or not, is this president nobody really expected to win.
Yeah, I had a friend of mine, Mike, who I really like as a comedian, and he is conservative, and you don't see it in the circles that you run, stand-up comedians in Chicago. You don't see, and he always alienates on Facebook, and people are always like, I can't believe, they don't even have an ad. They just get mad at him. He's almost a rabble-rouser, but he's a political satirist, and he's funny, but he's definitely pro-Trump. And his pro-Trump approach is, this is the funniest president we've ever had.
Right.
And he even made a joke yesterday on Facebook that was essentially talking about the corrupt media awards and that Trump wants to. He goes, I can't believe all the irate stand-up friends of mine that don't see the value of this joke. It's a funny joke that he is doing that, and that people get all mad about that. But it is true. When I think about it, I'm like, as a comic, I'm like, yeah, it is funny that the president would say I'm going to do an award show on Monday to give out trophies for the stuff that I don't like.
I understand that, but remember, all of comedy is always in the context of the comedy. And would we like Stephen, what is his name again? Stephen
Colbert.
Stephen Colbert. When he played the other role before, did we think he was funny when he was really playing that role? Did we think it was funny playing the role? Do we really like his character as the anal retentive conservative, or do we like him playing the anal retentive conservative in order to understand the opposite of that? Yeah. So I think you got to remember that comedy and politics are by nature connected to each other. And you know, it's whose ox you're goring. And what are the three rules of, by the way, what are the three rules of comedy? Audience.
Location.
Right. He was going to say that. So who else are you telling these jokes to? By the way, conservatives aren't turning that on.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, people watching those shows, those great ratings, is because of people who want to hear that. So I think we have this great coming together. But remember, the whole purpose of satire is to rip apart, to take apart, to deconstruct, to analyze, but not always to destroy, to make better.
Great convo. Al Jeaney, our resident philosopher here on the download, who's also the professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University Chicago. He is also the author of The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. You'll be back next month? What do you want to
I'll
talk about next?
Next?
What do you
month,
want to talk
about? I will take elocution lessons in order to improve my diction and pronunciation. We're going to talk about next week. How about 27 Rules for Totalitarianism?
I'm in, man.
Okay.
Let's just clear the deck. Let's just clear the deck. Let's keep going.
Nothing else for the month. We'll be preparing all month.
Al, great to see you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Jim from Evanston says Vaughn Meter is the comic that did the first family LP on the Making Fun of the Kennedys. Thanks, Jim. Al Jeaney, always great to have Al. I was making fun of him just for continually mispronouncing Stephen Colbert's name. But I only laugh because, you know, that, I don't think that's happening from anyone who's under 30 years old. You know? It is a hard name. But I enjoy that combo. And it's true. There's a lot that you can uncover. The idea of what I took away from that is the uniform. I think that's what's missing here. And this idea that the jester had a uniform. We always make fun of it. And jesters show up in these movies and stuff, and they got the stupid hats on, and they're... But if you think about that was their job, they're contraries, but they wore a uniform, so you knew that was their job. That's very telling. You think about how political satire has changed in the way that now one of the big issues that I think people who would call out about fake news, including the president calls that out, would say that, yeah, what happened to the uniform? We don't know. There's not a time and place. And I'm the first person to be like, hey, man, you can't just put it in the corner and take it out when you need to take it out. And obviously this president's pretty thin-skinned. You can tell by the way he responds. But I do think that that confuses people. Especially when you have this tremendous, tremendous creative talent from people on The Daily Show and Colbert and other places, that their talent is rewarded by ratings and people watching, millions of people watch those shows. And I can understand if you're on a different network and you're news and you're in the same ecosystem, even though you're not a comedy show, that you would want to incorporate that. That you'd want to do an eye roll, or you'd want to put your own spin on it. You'd want to do something that essentially captures that, you know, that spirit. And I can understand how that gets goofed up when people are like, wait a second, I thought this was the news. And then the blending of what's news and what's, you know, news programming or analysts. Like, we're not doing the news. I'm not sitting here next in Dateline, Tennessee. But some people will be like, if I say something, you know, make a joke in the carryout, people are like, fake news. I'm like, well, yeah, it is fake news. That's the whole point of that. It's fake news. But I also wonder, and I think that there's a bigger issue, and I think I would love for more. I don't want any more thought pieces on the internet. That's enough. But if we could unpack the idea of what happens when a political satirist becomes the man in power, if the job of the political satirist is to truth to power, but the person in power believes that their job as president is to give truth to power, I feel like we're stuck in the matrix. I'm just like, it's like, I don't know, like the looper. or what was Inception? Like we're in, I don't know, the walls, it's Doctor Strange, the walls are changing and moving around and I'm jumping from building to building. I don't even know what's happening. That's where I feel like I'm at right now, not understanding whose job is it? Speak truth to power? Oh, the president is speaking truth to his own power? That's where it gets goofy. But yeah. And I think about those late 60s comics, as you mentioned, I mean, Mort Saul, but George Carlin, Lenny Bruce, others who had something to say, not just about the president, but about what the president stood for. Or even, and I wonder in the case of, we were talking about President Obama, if for many say, oh, the media gave president passed, you know, this president passed because they liked him. But I wonder, because I wonder if maybe they did like him and he was a master at getting on Slow Jam the News on Fallon, or, you know, going on, like you mentioned, Between Two Ferns with Zach Galifianakis. But the satirist Bill Maher and the others, they went at what was happening in policies. And in, I remember there are a lot of jokes and things that wanted to be corrected when it came to inequality, Occupy Wall Street. Race relations, things like that, right?
Well, don't forget, Bill Maher went after Obama following that, I think it was the foreign policy debate.
Yeah, right.
With Romney.
Right.
The very next night, he came out on stage and said, I want my $1 million back. You tanked.
You tanked. Yeah, there's something to be said. I mean
that was stark.
I wonder, maybe I just have revisionist history on it in the way that I felt like there were a lot of people gave... that the time political satirists were focusing on other things like the Obama. I think of the Daily Show as a good example. Jon Stewart wasn't spending that much time on Obama. It was all the things that were in the way of Obama. And that's true. There's a point for that. But at the same time, I wonder, you know, what are some of the issues when you don't do what you normally do to the president? And in this case, I don't even know. But I mean, even the Kim Jong-un tweet yesterday was perfect satire.
Well, love him or hate him, Fox News exists for a reason.
And I wonder if Fox News falls... I was going to ask that about like a guy like Bill O'Reilly back in the day when he was doing his show. And even Rachel Maddow to a certain extent. Are they using some of the concepts that have been formed by political satire to inform the work that they do? They're mocking this news story. They're ripping it apart. They're trying to put extra commentary on it, and they're eye rolling all over the place. Both sides did that. That's
sure.
Kind of what made the birth of the Daily Show, right? Anyway, we'll go on to from political satire to sports satire, football satire,
or tragedy.
We need more. We need more football. Jokes in our lives, and we've got it in Chicago. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN, Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. Coming up, Adam Hogue, talk about what the Bears are doing with their coaching search, and of course, what they need to do to turn from one of the worst teams in the league to one of the best. I love that. I mean, you hear that all the time, people. They could be the next LA Rams. Okay, well, I'm listening.
Ryan, given the way the second half of the season played out, did you consider making a move at any point before the end of the regular season and maybe giving Vic Fangio a look? And if not, why not?
You know, no, we didn't. Our guys are playing hard, competing, and that is a credit to Coach Fox and what he's instilled here. So that was never in consideration.
Yes, download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Oh, that far too familiar feeling of doing radio segments, talking about what the Bears might do to improve in the offseason. It seems like that's a no-brainer for myself and Adam Hogue, who spent last offseason talking about what the Bears are going to do to improve upon their 3-13 season. Well, they finished this season 5-11, so I guess that's an improvement. They lost, if you weren't paying attention, most people weren't, on New Year's, was it New Year's Eve? That they, that Sunday, a woeful way to the Minnesota Vikings. Just the kind of game you were hoping to see some spark, a team that might show off a little bit moving forward with Mitchell Trubisky, a team that, just had some soul and some spirit, but not the case. The Bears were just pretty much lifeless on the field up in Minnesota. But now the season turns to the offseason. Of course, John Fox fired. The Chicago Bears right now up in Minnesota. They might be back, but they've got a lot of interviews on the table. Adam Hoge joins us all season long for the Monday evening quarterback tonight. The Thursday evening quarterback, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Adam covers the Bears for WGN Radio. You find all his stuff at WGNradio.com/Bears. Adam, great. Happy New Year, and great to talk to you, buddy.
Happy New Year, Justin. I believe Bear Force One is still in Minnesota right now, scheduled to interview Pat Shurmur, the Vikings offensive coordinator, tomorrow morning after interviewing defensive coordinator George Edwards tonight in Minnesota.
Okay, so that would be, so far they've interviewed Edwards and Fangio yesterday.
Correct.
And they've got DeFilippo and possibly Josh McDaniels, I think he showed. Where are we at with the Bears' scheduled meetings when it comes to interviews this week?
Yeah, I can run through it right now. So yesterday they talked to Vic Fangio, knocked that one out at Hallis Hall. Now, because of the NFL rules, you can interview teams with a first-round bye, but you have to travel to those cities. And by the way, this storm out on the East Coast is causing some problems. So the Bears went to Minnesota first today. Talk to George Edwards, the defensive coordinator. Important note there is he fulfills the Rooney Rule requirement that you have to interview at least one minority candidate. So the Bears did get that out of the way today. Tomorrow they will talk to Pat Shurmur in the morning. And then, yes, reportedly they will fly to Boston then and talk to Josh McDaniels out in Foxborough tomorrow before then going to Philadelphia and talking to John DeFilippo, the Eagles quarterbacks coach, on Saturday. And then Matt Nagy, the Chiefs offensive coordinator, is on the deck for next week, but they play this weekend, so that will not be until after. I don't think they can interview him until Monday, technically. So that's where it all stands, and take it all with a grain of salt because of the storm out on the East Coast. I don't know if that could impact travel plans tomorrow.
Would that be the list for the Chicago Bears? I mean, do you see more people coming, names surfacing as the process continues?
I would expect there to be more. There could be a couple college coaches that are interviewed that we never hear about. I would think they'd eventually leak out if they happen. But those will not necessarily be announced by the Bears. The Bears have been announcing their interviews so far, but would not be surprised if they don't announce college ones, just because those are really sensitive. You're talking about riling up an entire fan base, depending on which fan base it is, and you don't want to do that if you're not necessarily going to hire the guy. So we'll see. There could be some other assistants that pop up here and there as well. Steve Wilks, the Panthers defensive coordinator, was reportedly one of their targets, but so far that seems to have died down. And I hate to talk about this Rooney Rule like it's a check mark, because it's not really fair, but unfortunately the implementation of that rule is sometimes, you know, you're required to interview one minority candidate. And so some teams just interview one and that's it. That's just how we have to talk about it sometimes, unfortunately. So, but I will say that George Edwards, the Vikings defensive coordinator, I don't think the Bears are going to hire him, but beyond the Rooney Rule, it's great to talk to coordinators from within your own division, just to pick their brain and get some ideas on what you're doing offensively. I mean, don't you think they got something out? I mean, this guy coordinated defense against Mitch Trubisky on Sunday, like just a few days ago.
Yeah, right.
So, I mean, that's got to be great to be able to go in there and talk to George Edwards just about what you're doing as an organization. Pick their brain.
Second question. Mitchell Trubisky on that 3rd-and-8 route. How did you stop that? I saw today, I was looking at some stuff, that the national media kind of looks at the Chicago Bears vacancy at the head coach position is one of the more interesting ones that experienced and inexperienced coaches would want to land, because there's a franchise quarterback, there's good running game, the defense is solid. Is that the case? I mean, are people from around the league looking at this Chicago Bears head coaching position and saying, yes, I want that?
I think it totally depends on a case-by-case basis of how these candidates view Mitch Trubisky. I think it really comes down to that, because, yes, they do have at least enough pieces on defense to win by next year if you can put the offense in place, and that starts with the quarterback. So if you're a candidate out there and all of these coaching staffs get involved in the draft process starting – as soon as their season ends. Usually not until then. The college scouting staffs do it year-round. But as soon as your season ends, usually the coaches are asked to, hey, take a look at this guy. Take a look at this guy. So most of these candidates have watched Mitch Trubisky before. Now, John DeFilippo, the Eagles quarterbacks coach, obviously they had Carson Wentz already, so I don't know how closely they necessarily looked at Mitch Trubisky last year. But I'm assuming if he's interested in this Bears job, he's going to take the time to watch him very closely and have an opinion. And, you know, there was a report out there by old friend David Kaplan today that Matt Nagy, the Chiefs offensive coordinator, loves Trubisky. Would absolutely love to work with him here in Chicago. And that jives with what I've heard since the draft, in that the Chiefs were really, really interested in Mitch Trubisky and had made some phone calls about trading up for Mitch Trubisky before the Bears ended up doing that and drafting him. At that point, they turned their attention to Patrick Mahomes, who they also liked a lot and did trade up eventually to get Mahomes. But there could be some truth there with Matt Nagy, the Chiefs offense coordinator, loving Mitch Trubisky. And to me, that is the central question in how attractive this job is.
We've obviously talked about this a lot throughout the season, but the Chicago Bears, of course, it all hinges on the development of Mitchell Trubisky. And the offense, of course, has been one without weapons. We'll talk about that this hour. But is it a foregone conclusion that the Chicago Bears will pick an offensive-minded head coach to come in and coach the 2018 Bears?
I would say it's overwhelmingly likely. I don't think that Ryan Pace is somebody, though, who's going to go into this without seriously considering every single candidate he talks to. And that includes Vic Fangio, although I do think the Fangio interview was probably more to kind of keep him enticed and potentially talk about staying on staff as defensive coordinator. But look, it's no secret how much this organization has invested in Mitch Trubisky. And frankly, if you just listen to what Ryan Pace had to say on Monday, they're putting a lot on this kid's plate, a lot of pressure on this kid's plate. And in doing so, I think he really, really, really would like to pair the quarterback with a Sean Payton-like head coach like he had in New Orleans with Drew Brees and Sean Payton. And really, if you look at everything he's done here, a lot of it falls in line with what he experienced in New Orleans. He was there for 14 years. And you could talk about Adam Shaheen being his Jimmy Graham draft pick. You could talk about Tariq Cohen being his Darren Sproles, and Mitch Trubisky being his Drew Brees. So chances are he's going to go out there and get the quarterback, or I'm sorry, the head coach that is a lot like Sean Payton.
Yeah. Yeah, she wished that the Saints would have tanked this year, because Sean Payton probably would have been available. Adam Hoge, of course, on the line with us as we talk. 312-981-7200. Text already coming in. Let's talk. And this is a great point by 815. As much talking about John DeFilippo as and this counts for Nagy and other people involved here. As when you talk about young offensive minds, is there concern about the coaching staff, the experienced coaching staff that a wonder kid, a Doogie Howser, if you will, would bring to the table? I mean, someone who comes in who's young and obviously has the pedigree and is ready to change Chicago Bears football into a juggernaut in the 21st century. Do they have the experienced coaching staff that comes with it?
It's a great question. Probably depends on not only the relationships that specific coach has built in the league, how long they've been in the league. You know, in DeFilippo's case, he's done both college and the pros, but has been around the pros a lot in a number of different spots. You can either look at that negatively or positively in terms of the network maybe he has been able to build up in Oakland, been in Cleveland, Philadelphia, a couple other spots too. So I would imagine he knows a lot of people. Here's the best example I can bring up, though. Sean McVay took the Rams job at age 31. Who did he hire as his defensive coordinator? Wade Phillips.
Yeah, right.
Who's the second oldest assistant in the entire league, I believe. So behind Dick LeBeau, I think that's correct. Might have to look that up. But he's certainly one of the older assistants in the entire league, and he was able to bring him in. So certainly possible. All depends on who you know and probably to a certain extent who Ryan Pace knows.
You know, the other question I have is that thinking about Matt Nagy and it's interesting, and even John DeFilippo in Philadelphia, the systems that they run and the talent that they have on the offensive side of the ball and defensive side of the ball in some cases. Do you expect, and we kind of saw this with John Fox, I mean, he brought Danny Trevathan in and other players that he had coached elsewhere. Do you expect a little bit of that as well? Does that factor in when you talk about a Kansas City Chiefs offensive coordinator who might bring some of those explosive talents that might be on the free agent block?
Sure. I mean, I think that, well, first of all, you look at the style, and both of these offensive young gurus that we're talking about right now, John DeFilippo and Matt Nagy, Matt Nagy's directly on the Andy Reid coaching tree, West Coast style offense, which is, you know, pass heavy, certainly could fit Mitch Trubisky, but you know, you look at John DeFilippo, he's now working under Doug Peterson, who came from the Andy Reid coaching tree, so he's getting plenty of that too right now with Carson Wentz. So you're looking at similar situations there, and a style that certainly fits an offense where you do need weapons like that. And I think that this thing is going to really start to evolve and get put to, you know, the puzzle's really going to be put together pretty quickly once they determine who the coach is going to be and how it fits with the quarterback. And then certainly you got to bring in the weapons that fit that offense. So right now there's a lot of, you know, we don't knows, but as soon as you see these styles and you look at their past, we'll know pretty quick about the direction of this Bears offense.
Adam Hoge, of course, covers the Bears for WGN Radio. Find all his stuff at WGNRadio.com/Bears. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. It's our Thursday evening quarterback. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and let's talk. I'm interested in what Chicago Bears fans want. And, you know, we've been down this road.
And
the Mark Trestman stuff where we said, oh, we need an offensive coach. And then we lost that identity as a defense. And we're like, oh, we don't like this kind of football. Like, would we be okay with a defensive line coach to come in and coach the Chicago Bears with a big, bushy mustache? That's I feel like we might be looking at. Adam Hoge with us here on Thursday evening quarterback. Stay with us.
I would like to thank our fans. I know this hasn't been easy, and the results aren't what we all want. But their passion, their support is unmatched, and I can't thank them enough. I'm extremely appreciative to both George and Ted for their continued support. This is not something I take for granted, and I'm going to continue to do everything in my power to get the best staff, coaches, and players in place to make this city proud.
Brian Pace. It's Thursday evening quarterback here in Download 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman on the line. Adam Hoge, WGNRadio.com/Bears, where you can find out all the information and the writing and the podcast, everything that goes into the amazing work that Adam Hoge does covering the Bears. You can also get him at Adam Hoge on Twitter. All right, you know, let's talk about what, I mean, you heard it right there. I mean, Ryan Pace talking about apologizing to the fans for another losing season. It's not easy. What do you make of the fans right now? And what's you know, going back and forth in social media? Are people looking forward to this coaching hire? Is it just another the same? Or are we kind of drained by the process of being a loser in Chicago?
Well, I'm drained from having heard that same speech from the Bears front office and ownership. I mean, it just felt like the same old thing. I know they have to say that because they have to say something to the fans, but you know, those type of words don't really mean anything when this has been going on for 7 years, right? And you're going through now your third head coaching search in that amount of time. So, you know, I think the fans are fed up with losing, there's no question about that. But I also think that they're intrigued by this specific head coaching search because of the quarterback, right? You brought up a good point right before the break, Justin, that you can't just hire you didn't really say this exactly, but you really can't just hire a quarterback's coach to be your head coach, right? You can't. Yes, you want to pair Mitch with a great offensive mind that's not going to leave, because the problem is if you hire a good defensive coordinator who hires a great offensive coordinator that gets success out of Mitch for a year, that guy's going to get hired next year, right? Just like Adam Gase did after having 1 year of success with Jay Cutler. So that's the motivation to find an offensive guy as the head coach who because you're not going to lose him then. But we went through this with Mark Trestman. You can't just hire a quarterback's coach. He's got to be able to coach a whole team, the whole 53-man roster. So and he's also got to hire a good defensive coordinator, or then the defense falls apart, right? So there's a couple things at play here. One thing I do like about John DeFilippo, the Eagles quarterback's coach, is I got a text tonight from somebody who had worked with him at San Jose State, where he was the quarterback's coach and offensive coordinator for a couple of years earlier this decade. And that person said that he would run through a wall for DeFilippo, loves the guy. And it's those kinds of endorsements that make you think, okay, this guy can command a whole locker room, right? Because it's not just and he's not even calling the plays in Philadelphia right now, right? That doesn't necessarily mean he's going to come here and be the play caller, but he's still going to have that influence over the offense, and hopefully he can guide the whole team. And so far, the reports on him from that standpoint are very, very positive.
Oh man, it made me just think about Mark Trestman at the end with the offensive coordinator. I can't remember his name.
Aaron Kromer.
And all the stuff that was the dysfunction that was happening in that team. Mm-hmm. And you're right, Adam Gase, he had a I love how we think he had a great year with Jay Cutler, what he did, but they were 6-10 that season. Yeah. And he got a head coach job out of it. But I don't know. Like, part of me is this, I'll speak for fans, and I don't know if I'm willing to, and I love that the Bears have a quarterback, and I love that they were looking and being progressive to be part of the new NFL. But man, doesn't it get you excited when you have a shutdown defense that changes the course of a game? I mean, we're seeing all the highlights of Brian Urlacher put on the ballot for the Hall of Fame, and there's just something about it in the chemistry and the DNA here in Chicago that we want to see. Not just a defense that can manage a game, but we want to see a dominant defense on the field.
That's why I think the best case scenario is hiring an offensive head coach who, I don't know if they already have a relationship with Vic Fangio, but can convince Vic Fangio to stay here in Chicago. I think there's enough interest within the organization to do so. They're going to have to pay him a lot of money. His contract is up. But if you can make that head coaching hire and manage to keep Vic as your defensive coordinator, the players all love him. They don't want him to go anywhere. You can keep building on the success. You've had incremental success the last 3 years, and that could take another step forward next year. They're already in the top 10. They're at number 10. So what you're talking about, Justin, is attainable if you have the right defensive coordinator. And right now, the right defensive coordinator is already in your building. Right. He's just out of contract. So you have to find somebody that can keep him around and convince him with the money. Because if you lock up Vic for another 3-4 years with a new contract under a new head coach, that is going to be a great situation for the Chicago Bears.
Yeah. Adam Hoge with us. We're going to take a break and get to Rob's news here. And when we come back, I want to talk about, you know, obviously all eyes on the coaching situation for the Bears and what's going to happen here with a new head coach. But, you know, there has been a lot of talk about this team being ready to make a transition, not unlike what we saw in LA with the LA Rams, that next year they could compete. And I want to get your thought on who's going to be back next year and what you think needs to be improved. Because I've in a philosophy been arguing with friends for the last couple of weeks about what I'm calling the good to great philosophy. That there are a lot of good, serviceable B-minus players on the Bears.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point or another, we have to have a reckoning to say that B-minus is not good enough. Even though they're serviceable and they're great in the role that they're in, and maybe, you know, people say, oh, on paper, this guy's doing great. But it just feels like there are some areas of the Chicago Bears that if we want to be a playoff team, that position needs to be better than good, if that makes sense. Adam Hoge, WGNRadio.com/Bears. You can find his stuff. It covers the Bears for the station. We're doing our Thursday evening quarterback, 312-981-7200. Where do you want to see the Bears go this offseason, 2018? We'll take a quick break. We'll get Rob's news. Come back. Stay with us.
We have a lot of attractive things about our job, and I think it starts with a 23-year-old quarterback that we all feel good about. Our best players are young players. We have a very healthy cap. We're picking in the top 10 in the draft. We have 7 draft picks. And we also have a facility expansion that we're all very excited about. We'll put us as one of the top facilities in the NFL. So those are all things that I feel good about. I know our whole organization and our whole team is excited about. So those are only going to help us going forward.
It's Download Here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. It's a Thursday evening quarterback with Adam Hogue. Covers the Bears for WGN Radio. On the line with us, 312-981-7200. Jason wants to know why we haven't heard more college coaches being mentioned. You mentioned it a little bit earlier as well, Adam, but the idea of the big coaches like Dabo Sweeney and David Shaw and other people like that that do so well at the college ranks. And you hear from time to time, year to year, that they're looking to move college coaches up. But this year it's been all NFL assistants.
Well, I think part of that is because these college coaches, and I mentioned this earlier, want to keep it quiet. You know, because if Dabo Sweeney goes in interviews for the Bears job tomorrow, and who knows, maybe he already has. I doubt it, but maybe he has. But if that gets out there, Clemson, yeah, the whole university is going to, you know, freak out. So those coaches want to keep that more quiet and make sure that it's serious. Now, there are still some benefits for it to leak out. Sometimes it can lead to a contract extension and a little bit of a pay raise where they are. So that's why they usually do get out there at some point. But for the most part, I think that's why it's been quiet. At some point, you'll hear some college name interviewing for one of these NFL jobs. It almost happens every year.
You heard Ryan Pace there talking about, okay, so we've got seven draft picks, a high draft pick, other things that are important for the Chicago Bears moving forward. When you think about this roster, and obviously they have had tremendous issues with depth and injuries, some of the stars, watching that Vikings game, I was like, here we go again with this preseason-like lineup that they're throwing out there. But, I mean, there was a lot of trouble spots for this roster in 2017, not necessarily John Fox's issue. Where are we at with that? I mean, do you see this as a strong roster that's signed up? Where are the Bears at when it comes to cap space, where it comes to free agents? I mean, are we in a good position?
Well, you know, first of all, I agree with Pace with the cap, another top 10 draft pick, seven picks, assuming he doesn't trade them this year. So and the new facility, which the Bears have not talked enough about. I don't know why they've been so secretive about what this facility is going to be. I mean, they put out the renderings, but they didn't hold a press conference, and it was unrealistic for them to expect us to ask a ton of questions about the facility on this press conference Monday when you fired your head coach. So, but it is going to be impressive, and it does help. I think what you said, Justin, right before the news, I totally agree with you. And I went on a rant about this on our podcast maybe a month and a half ago or so, which is, yes, there are better players on this roster now, up and down the roster. It has improved, whether people want to admit it or not. It has improved over the last 3 years, which is why Ryan Pace is still around and why he got extended. But there's not a lot of... I mean, you're not looking at a roster with Hall of Famers.
Right.
There's no Brian Urlacher. There's no Lance Briggs. They still need to find those guys or continue to develop them. I mean, Leonard Floyd, if he can get his body right for the NFL and avoid injuries, I think he can have a double-digit sack season last year. I thought that could happen this year, and it might have had he not gotten hurt. So these guys got to continue to get better. But wouldn't it also be nice if whoever they draft at number 8 overall in April just steps on the field week one and is completely dominant?
Right.
They don't have those guys. They don't have those. And that's why I think across the board, no position except maybe quarterback, everything should be on the table. And by the way, you're going to hear me say this a lot between now and the draft. If Saquon Barkley is available at number 8, I would run to the podium and draft him. I don't care if Jordan Howard's on the team. I don't care if Tariq Cohen's on the team.
Yes,
if he
you.
Falls to number 8, he might be the best player in the entire draft. He's a different style, different level running back than Jordan Howard. He would immediately help the offense.
And it's the good to great philosophy. And I know that there's loyalty, and the running back position has been the one that has been somewhat successful for the Bears. But we saw against the Vikings a game that Jordan Howard, I don't even know what he ended up with, less than 20 yards rushing, and it's been that way. There's been a trend in that going in that direction for the Bears running game. There doesn't seem to be a lot of support, and I get it. I get that defenses are stacking the box against Jordan Howard and company, but the praise that's put on the Bears running game, to me as a fan, is a little incomplete.
I completely agree. And look, I like Jordan Howard as a player. You cannot take anything away from what he's done. Two 1,000-yard seasons to start his career, the only Bears running back ever to do that. It's very impressive. But I also, I don't mean to take anything away from him, but he sort of also seems like he's a product of the system, right?
Right.
And this is what we talk about with running backs all the time. It's why you can find good running backs in the middle rounds. Because as long as they're good at reading the holes, well, if they're good enough to be drafted, then they can hit those holes, and they're going to pile up yards. Now, what I like about Jordan Howard is that he always falls forward. He always picks up the extra yards. But I would also question his health going forward. You know, he played through a shoulder injury this year. I admired him for that. You never saw him on the injury report. He just played right through it, and that's great. But how is his body going to hold up over the next few years? And that's a question for any kind of big physical running back like that. So, again, we don't have to get off topic here, but
right.
No position is off limits to me, and that includes running back if Saquon Barkley is available at number
the
eight.
The Chicago Bears and Ryan Pace have had they've really seemed to be confident in their thriftiness. We've seen moves in the offseason, two offseasons with Ryan Pace, where he's gotten bargain deals on free agents who, you know, like we saw with Marcus Wheaton or Kendall Wright, or I think about who am I missing? Quentin Demps.
Quentin Demps, yeah.
Even Mike Glennon, to an extent. People get mad about his $18 million contract, but that's what you have to pay a starting quarterback in the NFL. And the idea they can get out of these contracts. But it's always about the idea that he's combing and he's finding the right, an efficient and thrifty deal for the Bears. They have a ton of cap space. Does the fan base and does the thought go out and get superstars, playmakers, people that you pay money to come play for the Chicago Bears?
Well, I would not be surprised if they get a little bit more of a splash on a single free agent this year. It's not like they haven't had these talks. You know, they were in the talks for Stephon Gilmore, the cornerback, last year, who ended up in New England. Janoris Jenkins the year before, cornerback. And eventually it just got to beyond the price range that they were comfortable with. And I respect that because most free agents don't work out. They just don't. You have to overpay in free agency. And even if they start well in year one and year two of their new contract, the lifetime in the NFL is just so short that you're already, when a guy hits free agency, he's already 4 years into the league. So the right. chances of him making another 4 or 5 years, which is what these contracts run, just percentage-wise, they're not high. So I actually really like Ryan Pace's free agency philosophy. Now, you'd like to see the hit rate much higher, but if you're not going to pay the big money, your hit rate's going even lower than what it normally is, which is not great. But I would much rather be in this position, as long as you're drafting okay, of, all right, this one didn't work out, but buy costs us nothing next year, which is what most of these contracts are. That allows you to take more shots next year. Because we just got out of this situation. Remember when the Bears signed Jared Allen? Another mm-hmm. bust. But Jay Cutler had to renegotiate his contract already. They had to put more money into his signing bonus. This was just the last contract he signed, that huge one. Just to free up enough cap room to sign Jared Allen, who then didn't work out. So their options were limited, and when they did go out and get a guy, it was somebody who was already over the hill,
yeah.
and they had to move the money around to make it happen.
That whole thing, because they let Julius Peppers roll on that. You know, he went to Green Bay, mm-hmm. and he had a successful career in Green Bay, and he's still playing. He's in the Carolina Panthers in a playoff game. And watching him hit Aaron Rodgers at the end of that game, it's just like,
yep.
it's terrible that we wouldn't pay that player, but then we went and paid the same amount of money for Jared Allen, who didn't work out in Chicago. But, I mean, yes, there's all those stories. But I also think about, I'm a little bit conflicted in whether or not Ryan Pace and the concept of approaching free agency the way he has worked, because Marcus Wheaton could go down as the biggest bust in free agent history. That dude had, what, two catches all season?
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
yeah.
and he was supposed to stretch the field. You start to see these players that you're like, I mean, even I think he's got to be on the hook for, and I know it's hard to say because of injuries, but Jarrell Freeman, the inside linebacker, hasn't seen the field more than a couple games in two seasons. Marcus Cooper, was supposed to be a starting cornerback. I don't know what happened to him, except we finally got to see him play and commit penalty after penalty in the game against the Vikings. Quentin Demps didn't see, what, he played one game? He got hurt and he was two games and he was out. I know that's injuries. I understand that. But it just seems to me that I don't know. I would think that there'd be, I mean, I think of even teams in our division who've had better success.
It was a bad year for Ryan Pace and his free agents. There's no, I mean, I was having this debate with a few guys in the media room on Monday. I mean, if you just even started a debate between which one was worse, Mike Glennon, Marcus Wheaton, Marcus Cooper.
Right?
I mean, that's a hard debate.
And he got an extension. You know what I mean? Those are terrible NFL players. I mean, and they're probably nice guys, and they probably are way better, and a lot of it's luck and things like that. But that was they did not work out in Chicago.
No, all three of them were brutal. And then Deion Sims was the other big one. He was okay, but didn't really do,
anything.
I mean, if I asked you to name a Deion Sims moment, can you do it? From this season, no,
he had a little bit of success with Mike Glennon, right? Like he had a little chemistry there, and none with Trubisky.
No, and his blocking was suspect at times too. So, he's got to improve. There's no question he's got to improve with his hits. I'm just saying, I don't hate the philosophy. Although, like if you got to pick and choose your battles, but if there was a no doubt about it wide receiver this year, which I'm not sure there is, by the way. The timing might be right to go out and get Mitch, one of those guys, right? And risk it a little bit. But that's why you have the cap flexibility to take your shots as long as they're calculated.
Let's take our – well, you know what? We'll keep going because we got one break here. But I let's transition into the draft class because you can make an argument that this was a good draft class in the sense that all the players that were drafted from the 2017 class, they made an impact on the field. The team was 5-11. Made a lot of rookie mistakes. For all the good, there was a lot of bad, including the quarterback, the franchise quarterback. Where does it stack up the draft class from 2017 after the first year?
I think very promising. You know, they drafted five guys. Four of them were on the field a lot this year. You would have liked to see Adam Shaheen on the field more, but I talked to him on Monday a little bit about just the physicality of the league, and he's going to be working on that in the offseason. Remember, he came from D2. I think that's a valid excuse for him that he wasn't quite ready from a physical standpoint. So he's got to have a big offseason. I think we saw flashes that he could be pretty good. And he's got great chemistry with Mitch Trubisky already. We don't really need to talk about Mitch. Everyone's seen what he did this year, but Tariq Cohen, most explosive playmaker on the entire team, probably.
Yeah.
That's very encouraging. And Eddie Jackson, for a rookie, I mean, he had one bad game in Philadelphia. It was a really bad game, but otherwise was really steady and at times made some huge plays, too. So that's encouraging. The fifth guy, which has been the forgotten guy, is Jordan Morgan, the offensive guard. And he came from a smaller school, too. Ends up taking a redshirt year with a shoulder injury. Don't really know if he can help going forward because we don't know much about him. But I'll tell you what, the Bears have a need for guard on their offensive line. They have a need a couple spots on their offensive line. So, you know, maybe with a redshirt year, he becomes something next year in training camp that we see develop and becomes pretty good. You know, Charles Leno was like that. He didn't do much early on the practice squad for the Bears and all of a sudden emerged when Jermaine Bushrod got hurt. So it's not unheard of.
312-981-7200. There was a question about Shaheen. We just talked about Shaheen. Jose on Twitter says, any way to keep Fangio pair him with Nagy or LaFleur, that would be perfect. The question I have is will you be expecting, if we do take one of these whiz kids to come in their early 30s to be the coach of the Chicago Bears, do they call their own plays? They do the sort of Doug Peterson, Sean McVay kind of thing where they take on the role of the offensive coordinator as well as the head coach?
It's possible. You know, I think Matt Nagy's interesting because Andy Reid was calling the plays, and there, as he pretty much has most of his career, and their offense started to sputter in the middle of the season. So Matt Nagy before that was just, you know, coordinating game plans and things like that during the week, but was not calling the plays, and Andy Reid gave him the play calling in the middle of the season, and all of a sudden the Chiefs bounce right back, and now they look pretty strong going to the playoffs. Probably worth watching the Chiefs game this weekend, Bears fans. I would watch the Chiefs game, look at what that offense looks like, how it's being called, because Matt Nagy will be calling those plays. As for John DeFilippo, Philadelphia, he's the quarterback's coach. He's not calling the plays. In fact, Doug Peterson calls the plays there in Philadelphia. So Frank Reich, their offensive coordinator, is not even doing it. So I don't know what these guys would want to do if they came here. DeFilippo was the OC in Cleveland a couple years ago did call the plays. I actually have that on my list of things to do. I want to go back and watch some film from that season to see what their offense looked like. But I, you know, they could, or they can make a great offensive coordinator hire and have someone else do it, which I don't hate. In fact, I kind of lean towards that. I like my head coach to be worried about the game and making smart game decisions and actually for once make. Wouldn't it be great to have a coach here in Chicago who could call timeouts correctly and challenge plays correctly? Because it seems like that's just not possible in Chicago.
When we talk about the free agency, I don't know if you call it class, but just to the market that will be available this offseason. Is it a strong one? I mean, are there a lot of players in the NFL that are out of contract that might be possible? And are there some that are even in the rumors of going to be cut from their contract?
You know, I will I'll just be 100% truthful here. With the coaching search, I haven't
dove completely
into the free agency list like normal. I did look at the wide receivers a couple weeks ago. Jarvis Landry could be in there. Devontae Adams was an option from Green Bay, but they just re-signed him to a big deal. I seem to remember there was
a couple of the Jacksonville Jaguars receivers.
That's who it was. Yeah. Robinson from Allen Robinson.
Who's on the IR, right?
Who they could franchise. That was a guy who I think is a great fit for the Bears if the Jaguars don't franchise him, because his value could be lower because I think he tore his ACL this year. So he's going to be coming off an injury, but put up some really big numbers the last couple of years and just sort of fits that Ryan Pace value type pick, I think. But they could franchise tag him and take him off the market.
312 wants to know about Kyle Fuller. Huge year for him. And you heard some of the people, I think it was during the game, the announcers were talking about Kyle Fuller being a possible franchise tag candidate. Where do the Bears stand with Kyle Fuller? Because before the year, we weren't sure he was going to make the team. And now he seems to be the best corner the Bears have.
Yeah, and I don't hate how the Bears handled this. I mean, they really put the pressure on him to have a good year and a contract year. They didn't pick up his fifth-year option. There was really no reason to do so last spring when that deadline came up. They signed Prince Amukamara. They signed Marcus Cooper. They said, hey, you're technically on the twos now. You're lower on the depth chart, Kyle. You got to play your way up. And he delivered with a strong season. So now the question is, how does Kyle Fuller react to that? And I think, you know, in his mind, it's probably going to be right now, how badly do they want me? You're not going to get a hometown discount now because of how you challenged him this year. That's just how it works, and that's fine. So now you got to pay up if you want to keep Kyle Fuller. I don't know about the franchise tag, because you're going to have to pay more for 1 year. It could be on the table. We'll see.
Yeah.
But I think Kyle Fuller's season overall was a little overrated. Didn't you find it a little interesting how teams kept throwing at him?
Yeah. They really, like felt like every week they were looking and saying that's the weak spot for the Bears.
Now, that being said, he did have a really strong year, and he's still young, and I don't think you can afford to give up a young cornerback.
And
like
I gotta
that
say, he's got he will be one of these guys, and we're looking for these playmakers. And you and I have talked about how the Bears defense just cannot find the ball whenever it's close near they go for knocking it down or not turning the ball over. But Kyle Fuller comes up in the run game. He seems to have his number called a lot in games when it's third and four and he's making a play. And that was the part that we look for as fans, to say, who are the numbers that continue to be called?
Yeah, and you know what? I love his run support. That goes back to his time at Virginia Tech. I remember Phil Emery raving about that when he drafted him, and I went back and looked at the tape, and this guy was flying in. That's why a lot of people thought he could be a safety in the NFL. So I think Kyle Fuller's done enough to stick around here. And I here's the thing you have to keep in mind. You guys just played the cut. I mean, Ryan Pace is up at the podium talking about how healthy their cap situation is. What kind of message does it send if, once again, you let another one of your first-round picks, I know that Ryan Pace didn't draft him, but another first-round pick walk out the door to another team when you have all that cap space that you're talking about? It just does not send the right message to that locker room, and they got to find a way to keep Kyle Fuller, in my opinion.
You know, when you think about playmakers, and I think about this defense, from Vic Fangio's defense, when it was healthy, you had outside linebackers and Pernell McPhee and Leonard Floyd, mixed with some really, I thought, some stellar play when healthy from Danny Trevathan. The Bears, although at the end of the season, I saw Sam Acho on the field, who played admirable. I think it was Lamar Houston was back. A lot of names that weren't necessarily household for the Bears defense on the line and in the linebacker situation. Their depth obviously challenged. Is it possible you see the Bears go out and find another playmaker at that position, at the outside linebacker, to rotate or possibly move on from someone like Pernell McPhee?
Absolutely. In fact, I would say very, very, very likely. I think Pernell McPhee, his time with the Bears could be over. His contract's not guaranteed going forward. But then you're talking about losing Pernell. You're talking about losing Willie Young, probably. You're talking about losing Lamar Houston. That's an interesting situation. Now he's back and played well at the end of the year. But these are all guys who are older, right? And have dealt with some injuries. So that really just leaves you Sam Acho, who is a fine player, but not really a pass rusher.
Right.
And Leonard Floyd. So this all of a sudden becomes a position that you have to address both in free agency and in the draft, in my opinion, maybe even with that number 8 overall pick to start with. And I would say yes, in free agency, they're going to go out and add some depth to that position because they need pass rush help.
Yeah. When's the East-West game?
The East-West game is in 2 weeks, I believe, because the Senior Bowl is on the 27th, so okay. The East-West Shrine game will be on the 20th.
So those are the games that we have to watch, because a lot of the players in the Senior Bowl and the East versus West game, they are players that possibly could be drafted by the Chicago Bears. And we'll have you – I want to talk about the draft and what to think about it. And I love the fact that, you know, there are games that we can watch to actually evaluate with our own eyes. And you do a great job of setting that, teeing that up for us. So we'll have you on before those games actually get played. Adam Hoge, of course, the man who covers the Chicago Bears for WGN Radio. You can find his stuff at WGNradio.com/Bears and all over the air and on Twitter at Adam Hoge, one of the best. And, of course, joins us all season long for the Monday evening quarterback tonight, the Thursday evening quarterback. We will check in and, of course, tell the story of the offseason of the 2018 Chicago Bears. Thanks, Adam.
It's going to be a wild couple weeks, Justin. Thank you.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure. Like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam.
Here we are.
That's right, on a new, I keep on saying day and time. It's right. New day, but not the same. It's same time. Thursday nights for the Swap Meet. We all own something that connects us to this great area that we live in, whether it's memorabilia or souvenir. We go out of our way to keep it from the trash bin. When we move, we take good care to preserve it. It's not junk. It's history. What do you have tonight? It's a swap meet. It's like Chicago Antique Roadshow. You call in and impress us with what you got, and we'll tell you if it's worth anything. 312-981-7200. It's a chance to brag about the things we've collected over the years. My guest tonight, as always, Greg Flam. He goes by DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter, and he's in studio. Greg, good to see you on a Thursday.
Great to see you. Yeah, it feels different.
You got a Thursday glow to you.
I do. It's that moisturizer. It's great. It's fun to switch nights because you get probably a different crowd.
Yeah.
The Wednesday
night people, you know, they're a little Thursday night's a little laid back. They're already in weekend mode.
The Wednesday night people have learned and they're out there picking.
Yeah,
so now
right.
we get the Thursday night people educated.
How was your holiday? Good?
It was awesome. Thank you. How was yours?
It was good. It was good. Happy New Year. Did you spend
Same
time
you?
Picking? Did you go around?
Or
you take a break?
No, this is kind of a break right now. Yeah.
Too cold to pick.
Yeah, I'm at Peloton every weekend selling there. So if it's not Thursday or Friday, I'm really not picking this season.
I was going to say, not too many garage sales happening.
But, you know, the word on the street, everyone's starting to jones a little bit, you know, to get out there and start picking. So, yeah,
well, maybe this
ready.
Weekend. Maybe when it gets up to the 30s, right?
Yeah, right.
All right. 312-981-7200. Okay, before we start, what'd you bring in tonight? I see a nice little poster here framed.
It's individual. Brochures from the late 50s to 78. I bring this stuff, you know, not because it's a huge wow factor, but it's stuff that is in people's basements or attics that people are paying money for. I mean, some of these are worth $5 to $20 a piece, and some can go higher as well. Obviously, supply and demand will determine
that.
So you got
a, let's see, you got a 78 Jeep Poster. Yep. You got a Mighty Chrysler.
57, yep.
1957. Still got the stamp, the...
yeah, Kirby Chappelle. 6200 Southwestern.
Nice. Get a little yeah, Dodge Colt. That was my first car. Dodge
really?
Colt. Yeah.
Yeah. The Chevy Vega. The similar to the, yeah, that same color, too.
That was yours?
Yeah. The orange color. Yeah. But yeah. And then 78 Audis.
Ooh,
and
look at those Audis.
65 Oldsmobile. Out of all of them, I think the Colt one is worth the most.
Yeah.
Like
of course.
20,
it is.
20 bucks.
Yeah. Of course. Well, that's why I had one.
Right.
You know,
of
I
course.
Was, I
you know,
Dodge Colt because I knew it was hot.
You got to sign yours. And,
right. Not, and I would. Probably be able to get 25, 50 bucks for the Dodge Colt after I was done with
the
it.
The Colt, yeah, right.
Yeah, and it wasn't too much to it.
Did you get it new or used? Or
it was my dad's old car, and I got it when I was 16, and I drove it till it died. And the thing, everyone knew I was coming because the muffler fell off. And it had, and it was one of those things in this, I just felt so bad for my neighbors because I would, in the morning when I would leave for school
right,
or whatever, I'd go warm it up,
yeah.
You know, in the driveway, and it would do this thing where bum, 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 bum. And then when it was ready to warm up, it would speed up a little bit.
Wow.
It'd be like, and then come down, so you knew it was warmed up, but I'd wake the whole neighbor up.
There you go.
Up with a Dodge Colt. Real strong. First car, Dodge Colt.
Yeah, well, you know.
Hey, I had an Alpine. I don't want to make a big deal about it, but I did have an Alpine. In
right. It's always the steers were worth more than the car, our first cars, right?
312-981-7200. All right, let's start it off with John. John, what do you want to brag about tonight, John?
Hi, I got a team autographed 1964 San Francisco Giants.
Ooh.
Okay.
With Willie Mays, Willie McCovey, Bobby Bonds, Juan Marichal, Jim Hart.
It's signed?
The whole team.
Yeah?
Yes.
Wow. And was that a photo or a baseball or what?
No, it's a baseball.
Baseball, okay.
I grew up close to Billy Pierce. His son, myself, were friends.
Okay.
And his dad played for him his last year.
Wow. Well, if you know anything about our show with team signed anything, photos, balls, footballs, sometimes some of the signatures are not authentic. They're what they call auto pen. So you have to, you know, I mean, hopefully in your case, it is all real. All the signatures are real. And then it can go up from there. But right now I'm saying a little bit over 600 for a team one. And let me see.
Is it the full team or is it just the stars?
No, the full team.
Yeah and I'm not seeing any of that
and
sold.
It is all authentic, too.
Sure.
There's no, computerized thing.
Sure.
What's a Willie Mays signature like? Is it strong? Is it good looking?
asking the caller,
John. What do you think? What's a Willie McCovey signature like? Is it strong?
To tell you the truth, I haven't looked at the ball in years.
Yeah,
do you put it in a little glass box? Like. Do you have it like in storage that way? That's hot.
Yeah,
yeah, one of those little glass.
Yeah,
things.
Right.
Yeah, and something like that, too, if you were to sell it, you know, the buyer and buyers are going to want it graded, you know, they're going to, you know, so you might have to send away and get that graded to get the most money for that. So that's something else to think about. But to ballpark it as is without being graded, you know, you're probably in the 400 to 600 range
to
start.
Wow, there you go. Way to start.
And I would do an auction as well. It could go higher than that.
There you go. Thanks, John.
Sounds good. Thank you.
All right, there you go.
Calling.
That's a good start, a 400 to 600.
Yep.
Usually you're like, this is so great. It's worth $15.
Right.
Yeah. 312-981-7200. Let's keep going. Let's go to Jim. Jim, you got the National Geographics. What do you want to brag about?
Well, it's not so much bragging. I'm to the point where I needed to start downsizing stuff and clear stuff out of my attic. I have all the National Geographics from 1925 on.
What?
A lot of duplicates and some of the earlier ones.
So you have like from 1925 to now?
Oh yeah, till current, till this.
How many of those are there? Thousands of magazines in your basement?
Oh, it's a lot of shelves full of the basement. It's heavy.
Wow.
But I don't have the maps.
I was going to ask about the maps.
Yeah, no, I have some of the maps, but mostly I do. Oh, I basically just have the magazines.
Yeah, my parents had a subscription to National Geographic as a kid. That is a boring magazine.
Yeah.
You would think.
Oh, I love it. I absolutely love it.
I know.
And we hit some libraries moving, so I got to buy some older ones and things. And so along the way, I've accumulated way more than I have room for if we downsize our home.
Okay.
If you look deep enough, though, you might see a boob.
Right.
Yeah,
that
would be the only reason.
Yeah.
Right.
years ago, but I get it. I get it.
Right. If you were to sell them, I would separate them by years, by each year, of course.
I don't know.
So if you are going to sell them, just to give you an idea, like 1914, which I know is earlier than what you have, but that's like $200 for the set for that year.
Wow. Seriously?
So, yeah. I'm trying to find like 1925 and
you can make hundreds of dollars off this, Jim. It's just I have a feeling you have to be pretty organized and diligent about it.
Yeah, you'll have to sort it by year. But the good thing is it's media rate. So your shipping, if you were to ship that, wouldn't cost that much.
Yeah.
So that's
good. Interesting. Is it like an eBay thing, or how do I do that?
Yeah, you could do it there. You could do any other online site. But, yeah, obviously eBay is probably the most common. Yeah. And like I said, media rate, throw a signature. I put a signature on anything over like $40-$50 just to be safe.
Well, that's very cool. I appreciate the information because they're sorted year by year. Maybe I could start picking off a year or two at a time.
Make some room for the new magazines that are coming in.
Right.
Or for Smaller House. Yeah.
Right. Cool.
Thanks, Jim. All right. 312-981-7200. We're getting some Thursday night. People are excited.
A little bit of higher
Let's go to another Jim. Jim, what do you want to brag about, Jim?
Happy New Year, guys.
Happy New Year.
Whatever day you go to, I'm going to follow you.
Right. Awesome. We like to hear that.
I've got a Cheech and Chong album called Bamboo.
Yeah.
And it's still, and you open it up, and there's a giant rolling paper in
it.
Nice.
Of course there is.
Now all I need is some of that Denver stuff, and we'll be in. All
right. And coming soon to a state near you, right?
Yeah, right. Not if Jeff Sessions says anything to say about it.
Right.
That's a famous record, right?
Yeah, it is.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Like the idea that it folds out and there's rolling papers in it. So
yep.
Cheech and Chong.
No, it's got one big giant rolling paper for like making a, I don't know, like a party joint or something.
Right.
I don't know.
Did that come with a sticker as well, do you know? Because I'm seeing some with a sticker as well. But
this one doesn't have a sticker.
That's all right. You're probably looking to start about $20, $25. Obviously, it was mass-produced, so there's a lot out there. But the key is, like you said, the big rolling paper that adds value.
Yeah.
So,
another thing I'll have you guys check on another time, though, is I've got all my wife's Beatle albums that have never been opened.
Wow. What? Now you're talking some big money.
She's got, it's unbelievable. There's at least 15 albums there.
Just unopened? Like she just
opened.
Wow.
She just decided, she's like, this is just not the music for me. Stop buying me Beatles records.
Yeah, well,
yeah,
I tell you, if you walked into Wolves and Peloton, you'd be tackled, I think, if you brought those
in.
And you also have my Facebook page. If you ever do want to sell them or get the value or where you should start with them, feel free to message
me. Just go to Add to Page Picker.
Yep.
All right.
Thanks,
sounds great.
All right. Thanks. Good luck.
Oh, darn it. Happy
thanks.
New Year. Trigger finger there. Sorry about that. 312-981-7200. All right. Let's do one more call, then we'll take a break. Let's go to Craig. Craig, what do you want to brag about, bud?
I have Who's Who in Baseball. It's like a Reader's Digest-sized baseball book that shows statistics of every player. And the company recently went belly up. They no longer produce them.
Okay.
I have them from either 82 or from 88 onward.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm serious.
So you've got the 80s baseball players references?
I got Who's Who in Baseball from like either 82 or 88.
I'll bet you I can name rosters. Like, this is my thing. Craig, this is my thing.
I love baseball statistics. I would read the book from cover to cover, and I would put them downstairs. They're in a cool, cold room that's been, they're down there for like years.
I love those
digests.
I was thinking
of throwing it away, but I'm sure they're worth something.
They have to be, right? They were almost like Reader's Digest, but just stats. I had some of those.
Really
What's the company? Do you know the company? You remember?
I don't remember the company without going downstairs and getting one, but they didn't produce them this year, and I was wondering why, so I went online, and they said they were sold.
Yeah.
I was wondering what they're worth.
Unfortunately, they're not as high as you might think. We need Beats by Zim on this sound effect. But yeah, they're like $10 to $25 depending on the condition.
Come on,
some might be more. I mean, and you might want to, if you didn't get them yourself, sometimes you can find them at a garage sale. They'll have some signatures in them, so that's what you need to look for.
Who?
I got them at like Jewel. Jewel would sell them every year. 7-Eleven would sell them every year.
Yeah.
Who played shortstop for the 1988 Cincinnati Reds?
I want to say Johnny Bench was the catcher.
Well, that's early. That's the 70s.
I don't remember without going downstairs with my book.
Barry Larkin.
There you go.
I was going early. I thought you said
Sabo. You got Sabo at the hot corner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the other side, I forgot who was playing first at that point. But the Reds and the Reds are classic late 80s. Eric Davis was on that team. Maybe he had a couple other guys. Anyway, I could do this all day. We can do Minnesota Twins.
Right.
So they're not worth nothing?
Yeah, I mean, they're $15 to $25. Again, some years might be better than others. But
okay,
yeah,
how do I go about finding out? Do I
Do a search on eBay and just make sure. I want to tell everyone this is, don't just look it up and take that price. You have to click sold on the left side on your computer
or on your
phone. There's a filter part on the phone and click sold. So that will give you like what they're really going for and what people are paying for.
All right. Thanks, Craig.
Thanks.
What about my encyclopedic knowledge of 80s baseball players? Is that worth anything?
You're doing it right now, Justin. You're the man right here.
I get $10 to $15 on that?
Oh, man.
I can tell you who played left field for the A's.
It's invaluable. Nice.
That's my favorite thing in the world. We just do 80s baseball for the rest. Just derail the swap meet entirely so I can just continue to talk about who played second base for the... I don't even know who the second base for the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Yep.
All right, 312-981-7200. Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker in studio. We're doing the swap meet. We'll take a quick break. Come back. Continue. Stay with us. It's a swap meet here on the download, 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman with Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. We are evaluating your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk. 312-981-7200 is the phone number to call. I got great stuff, and I want to thank 219 said Hal Morris from Munster, Indiana was playing first for those Cincinnati Reds.
Nice.
I'm telling you, we can do it all night.
See, Download Nation. Can count on them.
Oh,
that's awesome.
That's so good. All right. 815 says, I have an original Mr. Machine in working order in its original box. What would it be worth? An original Mr. Machine.
That surprised me. One recently sold for over $450.
What?
Yeah, in the box.
What is a Mr. Machine?
It looks like a toy. It was made by Ideal Company, and they were out of Hollis, New York, I think. And Ideal Toys, if you see that brand, they're usually good pickup at garage sales or estate sales. You can usually get them for under $6, $7, and they usually return. Pretty well. But yeah, that game, on average it's like $250, but if you have it in the box, I say you're probably in the $400 range.
Wow.
Then.
Man, this is the Thursday night crowd bringing hundreds of dollars. They're not messing around.
Right. It's like
Wednesday night, we're like, some $750.
Yeah.
Maybe get a 10 spot.
Yep.
These guys are $400 or $500.
Yep.
630 says, I got a fully operational 1924 Underwood typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, there's a picture of it too.
Yep.
It's a typewriter. A fully operational one, 1924 Underwood typewriter. Do these things go for stuff?
Yeah, they're in the $300 range as
what?
Well. Yeah, so working condition, maybe a little bit more than that. But people are just buying them, just for decoration. It doesn't even have to be working. They'll pay, $75, $150 for non-working.
Really?
Yep.
Jeez, man.
I know.
I really need to get out to my parents' pole barn, go through my stuff, man. Yep. I just feel like I could pay like a month's rent
easily.
With all the garbage that I've got in the old bins.
Yep.
Are overly pinned Beastie Boys posters worth anything? Maybe some tape on the back ripped
not
the corners,
so much,
not so much.
Yeah, if they weren't pinned or anything, then, that'd probably be $25 to $40 for that poster.
Like a Lamborghini? Like maybe from when I was 13, like a really strong red Lamborghini with ripped corners,
not
tape
so much,
on them, not as much.
Now you're bringing us back to Wednesdays.
That's what I bring to this. I have a feeling there'll be a lot of good stuff in there. All right, let's go to you Ken. Sure. Ken, what do you want to brag about, Ken?
Sorry, I collect pole lamps.
Okay.
Floor-to-ceiling static pole lamps. You know what I'm talking
pole
about?
Pole lamps?
P-O-L-E, pole.
Right, and what was the brand?
Sorry, what?
Was there a brand that you mentioned?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No, there's no brand. There are various ones. But, they're on springs from the floor to the ceiling.
Yeah, right. Yeah, mid-century modern, right.
Mid-century modern. Yeah, I've got five of them.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
just garage sale, you know.
Yeah, I wish we kept ours. Growing up, we had one. And we also had the spring-loaded pole, like album racks. There was like three of them on a spring-loaded, like the lamp.
Oh, yeah, holy.
Yeah, so yeah, no, that's cool. How long, so you collect them? You?
Well, I don't know if I collect them. I use them. They're plugged in.
Yeah.
I kind of use them.
Okay. Let me see. What
yeah, I mean, the more hideous, the better.
Right.
And what I was thinking, you said the albums. I saw somebody get something delivered today on my porch, and I thought, when was the last time I saw a record album in a cardboard box laying on your porch?
Oh, yeah. Really? Someone,
back in, what, Columbia House days? Right?
Columbia House. That's
right.
Exactly what I'm thinking.
Yeah. Like it was vinyl?
On vinyl, yeah. Yep. Yeah.
You know, once in a while, bands will come through when they do Studio 435, and they'll play here, and at the end, they're like, we'd like to give you this, and it's a vinyl, like, in the whole thing, and I'm like, I don't have a way to play this at all. Like, I work at a radio station. I don't even know where the turntables are in this
right.
place. I mean, it's awesome. It looks awesome. It's art. It's
right.
cool. It's cool, but I don't know how to play it.
Yeah.
You can always give them to me.
Right.
I'll do that. I'll put them in the mail so they can show up on your they can show up on your doorstep in a cardboard box.
Right.
All right, what do you got, Greg?
Some are selling in the 300 range, but there are people asking over 2,000 for some of these.
Wow.
So yeah, but for the sold prices are usually in the 250 to 300 range, working condition, of course.
All right. 312-981-7200. We're playing the swap meet here on Thursdays, our brand new time. It's the same time, 10 o'clock, but it's a brand new day. It's like when they moved Wings from Wednesday to Thursday,
right.
Or as someone called out earlier, Caroline in the City. Swap meet is like the Caroline in the City
right.
of the download. We just moved it. It was doing so well on Wednesdays, we said it's prime time,
yep.
time for Thursdays. All right, we got a lot of text, people on the line as well, 312-981-7200. Before we do that, let's get an update on tonight's news. It's the download. Stay with us.
It's time for swap meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman
and Greg Flam.
Here we are.
Here we are on Thursday nights now. The Swap Meet 2018 moving from Wednesdays to Thursdays. 312-981-7200. The Thursday night crowd getting big paychecks.
Bringing it. Yep.
Payouts. People coming in with good stuff. Saying, hey, I got this little thing. Is it worth anything? And Greg is giving the goods. Yeah, saying,
making it rain.
Bucks, making it rain.
As the kids say.
As the kids. All right, here we go. David, start us off. What do you want to brag about, bud?
Yeah, I've got a three-quarter size commemorative football that has about 45 signatures from the championship Bears Super Bowl team. It's got the coach. It's got wow. Walter. Singletary, Hampton, Dent, almost the entire team.
How about a Tyrone Keyes?
Sorry?
Is there a Tyrone Keyes on there?
He's
on there?
Played.
Okay.
Oh, wow. He is on there, yeah. Yeah, he's wow. there. It's almost everybody. It's about 40 or so, 45 names on that.
Did we try to figure out who's not on it? Is Jeff Fisher not on it? Didn't he play on the 85 Bears?
He was.
I don't have it in front of me, so I don't know if he's particularly on that, but I know all the the big
kicker?
Ones are there.
He returned punts, and I think he was kind of like the practice squad guy, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think he was like, he got injured and then ended up helping out Buddy Ryan a lot.
Right.
So I don't know if he played any.
Willie Gault there, so.
Okay. I will say this. I was telling this earlier, David, you like this as Greg looks this up. I found out a new way to watch TV. This during the holiday season, I have Comcast, and I got the new remote that you can talk to. But the TV told me that if I say my search and then I put on YouTube on the back end, it'll search YouTube for me, and I can watch YouTube through Comcast. And so you know what the first thing I did? As I said, 85 Bears versus Dallas Cowboys on YouTube, the full game. And I watched one night, my wife was so annoyed with me, I watched an hour and a half of the Summerall Madden Bears Cowboys 85 game. It was a great game. The Bears defense had Danny White on his heels the entire time. It was awesome. So if you get a chance, go check.
Awesome.
Yeah, go check that game out. That,
Steve Fuller.
Fuller was quarterback, right?
Yep.
And Peyton wasn't. It was all defense. Defense just was all. They won that game anyway.
Yep.
Yeah.
Let's move on from that regular season Fritz, game.
Yeah, I mean, Fritz Perry scored in the Super Bowl and Walter didn't.
Yeah, right. That's true. That's true. What do you got?
Well, not as many signatures as he has, but they're like 400 plus. I mean, with as many signatures.
$400?
Yeah.
And, for the 85 Bears? Yeah. You'd think that'd be $5. It feels like there's 85 Bears everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, just a Peyton one, 400 really? Plus. Yeah, just for Peyton's signature on it. On a football.
Oh, man. I got to tell my childhood friend, Richie Fischella, he had a...
But again, you know,
he had a ball signed by Peyton. You get $400 for that.
Yeah. Again, you know, conditions, everything. If you grade it, you'll get more money. If you don't grade it, you know, you give up a few hundred. So, you know, if you are going to sell it, look into that.
All right. Thanks, David.
Okay, great. Thanks so much.
Thanks for calling.
That's good stuff.
Yep.
I had a Michael Jordan poster early on.
Which one?
It was an early one where he's a young guy dunking, and my neighbor worked as a maintenance guy in one of the buildings downtown that he would come into, and he got him to sign it, so it wasn't one of those. And then I mean, it's wrinkled, it's got a lot of rips on the corners,
yeah,
and I don't think it made it through the first like spring cleaning that I was assigned to do to my bedroom when it got ripped in half or something like that. But I had that for a while. It's pretty cool, huh?
Yeah, you're.
I'm the perfect guy for the swap meet. Everything that I had of value, well, I ruined within 6 months.
We have to do the one episode a year. What did we call it? Ambiguous swap meet. What's the name of it?
All right. Here we go. Steve, what do you got? What do you want to brag about, Steve?
Hello?
Hi,
Hello.
Steve.
What do you want to brag about, bud? You're on.
Hey, how you doing? I got a hockey puck by Bobby Hall.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Yeah, little story behind it, real quick. I don't want to hold the radio
no,
up.
No, go ahead. That's this is what here. It's for, stories.
Okay. I'll start by saying I'm not a big sports fan. I just started listening to the radio on the way home. I got tired of the music, and I like to talk. But, I was in the alley when I was younger, about 14, and some kids were playing hockey, and they took a hockey puck out of an abandoned garage. And they threw it on the ground, and they were playing with it for about 10 minutes and walked away, left the puck there. I picked it up, and I noticed there was a face on it with an autograph, brought it home. I took my dad, and he said, it's Bobby Hall. So,
After it's been played with.
5 years ago, I went and I got it. What's that?
5 years ago, what happened?
Oh, I went and I got it checked out, and it's pretty real. So
that's great.
Yeah. So I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, Bobby Hall is probably in the 100 to 150 range, depending on condition, but yours has been played with now. So you're probably still in the $80 to $100 range, though, I would think.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
That's good, man. Thanks
for calling.
Nice talking to you guys. Take it easy.
Nice. Take care. Happy New Year. All right, let's keep going. 312-981-7200. We're on a sports roll.
Yep.
Let's keep going. Let's go to Len. Len, what do you want to brag about, Len?
You know, about 20 years ago, my favorite baseball player ever in Chicago was Dick Allen.
Yeah.
Yes. And about 25 years ago, I'm helping a friend move who was a customer of mine at the Mercantile Exchange. He was a trader. And I see the Dick Allen 40-ounce bat sitting in the corner. And, you know, I said, Craig, can I have that bat instead of you giving me a Christmas bonus this year? And turns out his dad was good friends with John Allen, who was the owner of the Sox when Dick Allen played.
Okay.
And John Allen gave the bat to my friend's dad.
Wow.
And he gave me that bat. And, you know, that's the last time anyone ever used a 40-ounce bat. I think the largest bat now is about 34 ounces.
Right.
And what's cool about the bat, though, is all the weight's at the end of it. So actually, when you swing it, it doesn't feel like 40 ounces.
Right.
It's like a perfect 16-inch softball bat.
Mm.
You know, you want the bigger bat so you can just club that thing.
Yep.
Yeah. But, he had the coolest swing ever. And he had it was called a buggy whip swing.
Yep.
Where you actually tip the head of the bat towards the pitcher, and then you just started all the momentum. And when you came through the hitting zone, I mean, he had that thing just, you know, sweeping through.
What does the signed bat go for? Greg?
There aren't any that recently sold, but there are quite a few available, ranging from $175 to $3,500.
But I can tell you the history of his bats. He used Adirondacks that season.
Okay.
So those are the game used bats are pretty valuable. They're probably over a thousand.
Yeah, that's probably the 3,500 ones. It does say game used.
His All-Star bat is worth about $7,000.
Right.
The 67 All-Star game.
Okay.
It's the K55 model. It was a Louisville slugger. The big thing in bats is before early 80s, guys only ordered, you know, a dozen or so bats, because the memorabilia thing really started kicking in like 77, 78.
Right. Okay.
Then they started ordering all these bats up until today.
Right.
So the market is saturated now, but back then, you know, Mickey Mantle used the same model, the K55 Louisville slugger. His 61 bat is worth about $100,000.
Wow.
Len, yeah. Thank you for the bat history.
That is awesome. Good information.
Awesome. Good work. Thank you, buddy.
Well, I'm got a lot of useless knowledge.
Welcome to the swap meet,
right,
buddy.
We need it.
Happy New Year. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
All right.
There you go. All right. We need more people like Len, right? Useless knowledge kills it on this show. 312-981-7200. 773's got a tin advertising sign for Campbell's Soup. Campbell's Kids.
Yep.
Okay. Had it up on the kitchen wall for over a doorway for over 40 years. Perfect condition. It's like a poster with a bunch of kids just hanging out, like flexing muscles. And
right.
Says Campbell's Soup, give vigor and strength.
Yeah, I'm not finding the original vintage
kids
ones, but that same sign that he sent in via text, I find it repro, and it's like 25, 40, but obviously his 40-year-old one, I'd have to say it's a few hundred, you know, easily 300 to 400.
That's nice. I like that, though.
Mm-hmm.
All right, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Let's keep going here. 219 says, my wife's looking to get rid of a bunch of Disney original VHS tapes going back years, including original movies like Fun and Fancy Free, Beauty and the Beast, and Little Mermaid. They're in the original boxes, and I was just wondering, there's some value to that collection. We got at least 30 of them.
Wow.
Wow, yeah.
As a lot, I don't know. I'd have to put that maybe in the $400 range as a lot. Some could be $100, $135. There's we've talked about in the past this Black Diamond Disney thing. Some are, you know, you'll see sold for $3,000. I can't explain it. I don't know what to tell you other than the longer story is some executives with Disney got these rare Black Diamond tapes,
right.
and now it's misinformation throughout the internet. It's crazy. But yeah, realistically, I think you're at about $75 to $125 per tape.
All right. Per tape?
Yeah, per tape. If they're the original, there's the white clamshell, and then they switched. So if they're the white clamshell, you're easily in the $100 range per tape.
Nice. Wow. I can go back and look and see what I can.
But most are $10, so just so you know, you have to do your homework on it.
Darn it. But I bent, kind of broken Lion King.
Right.
Where are we at with that?
Yeah, like $4, yeah.
Well, taped off of AMC. Is that good anything? All right, 312-981-7200. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll return and finish out tonight's inaugural Thursday night voyage. That is the swap meet. Greg Flamm is here. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. Right, it's a swap meet here, 312-981-7200, our first Thursday night swap meet. Greg Flamm with us, at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. Joins us every week here. It'll be Thursday nights, 10 to 11. Let's get to it. Howard, what do you want to brag about, Howard?
Hey, guys. While you're doing all this sports stuff, I got something totally unrelated.
Yeah, okay.
All right, I'm in. My dad had a business, and I still have the IBM PC Junior with a dot matrix printer and the floppy disk.
Wow.
It's all in operating condition.
Wow.
From back in the 80s.
That's amazing.
It is.
Don't do the update.
Right.
There are no updates for it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you're probably in the $250 range, $300 range.
Oh, come on. That's it?
It's just a shame, you know, that the Apple stuff from that era gets way more than
what? Yeah, than, how can I can buy a Dell laptop for that much money, a right. new one.
Yep.
How does an IBM PC Junior only get you $300?
That's what they're going for.
Is there someone I can talk to? Is there a manager I can talk?
Like customer
well,
service
I figured part. I figure there probably wasn't a big collectible market for stuff like that.
No, there
but
is.
And Ron, I've got it.
No, you'll definitely be able to sell that if you put that out.
Yeah, but still. Ugh.
I know it's only $350, so try to do it's local pickup because you'll lose a lot on shipping.
That's $300 in my pocket. Right. I don't need to have it anymore.
Right.
I say hold on to it for another 50 years. See what happens.
Pack it away.
That's it. Have a good night.
Awesome. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, buddy. All right, let's go to Todd. Todd gets us back on the sports kick. What do you got, Todd? What do you want to brag about?
Hey, I've got Super Bowl I and Super Bowl II programs. Ooh. Above average condition, not pristine. Mm-hmm. Pages are white and white. They're both signed by Bart Starr,
wow.
15, SB1 MVP and SB2 MVP.
Wasn't he beating like the Kansas City Chiefs?
They're with Tri-Sports authenticated.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, that
but that's
definitely
right. Rest
helps.
Of Super Bowl One, didn't the Packers beat the Chiefs, or was that it?
Yeah, it was Packers Chiefs in one.
Yeah, and then Oakland.
Yep. Okay.
They're all over the place, but since yours is graded, you could probably be on the higher side. One sold recently for $300, and one also sold for $1,500. So I'd say you're more in the $1,000, $1,500, maybe more, because you're graded. And definitely do an auction if you were to sell.
There you go. Jeez. Todd, you're the winner tonight.
Thank you.
Nice work. Huh?
Thank you.
So Bart Starr putting his signature on a program is more money than an IBM PC computer from the 80s.
Yeah. That makes sense.
I don't know about that.
Yep. Now, you know, like an Apple, whatever the first computer was, that'd be different.
Right. All right. Let's keep going here. I've 815 says, my friend has an original 2XL. What does that mean?
That I'm not sure, other than there was a robot called 2XL that played tapes and you can like do a quiz with it. It was made by Tiger Electronics in the, I want to say, late 70s, early 80s. They then went on to make one that used either data cartridges or CDs. But I found one, and it was the cassette version. I was able to clean it up and sell for like $40. Huh. So with no tapes, you know, no box, nothing, just a robot. I'm assuming that's what he's talking about. If it's something else, please text in a picture.
Maybe it's like a double XL t-shirt.
Right.
Guns N' Roses t-shirt.
You know, and it's, you punch in 2XL on eBay, you're getting
a lot of stuff.
100,000 items,
708 says, I have a few old Life magazines. I know you said taking the ads out and framing them would be worth more than the magazines themselves.
This is true.
What kind of ads are most sought after?
Okay, the ads you want to look for in any of the vintage magazines will be car ads, stereo ads, some of the like, you know, cigarette or liquor ads, especially if they have a celebrity with it, you know. But in with Life magazine, their ads weren't really anything exceptionable. The issues you want to look for with Life are obviously Beatles and Marilyn Monroe. Those can get $200 each. But the magazine that I really find some great ads is Look magazine is the one, you know, you should be looking for. Right.
Sure.
So that one, that has all had some great ads. I found one that had a 8-track tape carousel, an ad for a company in England that made this 8-track tape carousel. I've never seen that thing in my life. And then to see an ad for it was even cooler. Wow. So,
all right. Let's go to Derek. Derek, what do you want to brag about, Derek?
I have the original Nintendo with a bunch of games.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Is that a Duck Hunt? You got Duck Hunt on that one?
I've got Duck Hunt.
Mike How Tyson about Contra? You got Contra?
I've got Contra.
Contra, up, up, down, down, 1-2, 1-2.
Top 10 NES games. Go.
ABAB, right?
All right. Okay, so do you have the box? I mean, what condition is it in?
No. Okay. It's just regular Nintendo. Yeah. The box, the console itself looks fine. No dents or anything, scratches or anything like that.
I've got a Nintendo, like kind of like the Nintendo Super Nintendo that I've got in my house, and the wires to the controller are completely like frayed.
Yep.
It still works. Once in a while, it kind of goes on the fritz, especially when I'm trying to go in for a layup.
It shows
my 90s Bulls.
Right.
But what's that word? No, what do you got for the original Nintendo? Not in the box.
Not in the box. I would still price, look up each individual game, because some of those games could be like $50 to $100, maybe more. But it, as far as a lot, if they're kind of the $5 games individually, you're probably looking at $80 to $130 if it works. But I would probably just sell like the game unit itself with the controllers, all the wires, of course, and maybe just with Duck Hunt, just sell that for like $80 to $100.
You got Spy Hunter?
I don't remember. I've got like 30 games.
How about RBI Baseball? That was my fave. I think it was RBI Baseball. Home Run Baseball? RBI Baseball?
Mm-hmm.
I've got a baseball game. I haven't looked at them in years.
Yeah,
you know,
I like them. All right, Derek.
You can play on your phone now.
Yeah, well, look it up. You might get some. Might get some money off the specific games. Thanks, right. Derek. Let's keep moving here. Let's go to Ken. I'm confused on this. Ken, what do you want to brag about, Ken?
I've got two hand clippers. When they used to cut hair with hand clippers that were not electric.
Oh, interesting.
So those things are basically a dime a dozen, but. The two big names are Oster and Andis, and I have them both in the box, and one of them has the, I don't remember which one, one of them has the cutting hair instructions. Now, these are the kind of the barbers use.
This I was going to say, how'd you get them? Are you a barber?
Well, yes, I'm a barber, but I got it through a sale, and the guy didn't know what it was, and I still, but because it was the clipper that went with the box, I went with it. It's called Triple Zero, and it was the same size clipper that the box was advertising.
Wow.
So they're hand cool. clippers.
I like that. Hand clippers. Not
do you remember that? Or do you remember anybody talking about them?
No, I have no idea.
When you were little and got cut by, it pulled on the side by the sideburns, and it would always pull, and you know, ow.
Yeah, right.
Because you weren't moving your hand fast right. enough to cut it.
Wow.
But have you ever seen one of those?
I haven't, no.
I haven't until now. Haven't. I'm looking them up, and there's quite a few. And they do sell, so they're definitely selling. But they're just not that high or as high as you would think. Some have sold
a lot of them don't have brand names, but being Andis and Oster, yeah. I thought maybe that's
I looked up Oster for you, and they go right. for $10 and up. So
that's all?
Oh, yeah, I mean, there might be a couple here that are like 40 or 50, but for the most part,
yeah.
And I think it's just like you said, people just don't know what they are, or they're just right. kind of a generational thing where, you know, as the generations go on, people can't appreciate
it. Well, yeah.
Thanks, Ken.
Some people will see. Okay. Take care.
Great. Right. Thanks for calling.
Sorry to cut him off there. We only got 2 minutes left here.
Yep.
Bob, what do you got, Bob? What do you want to brag about?
In 1951. The baseball all-star game, I believe, was held at Comiskey Park, and my dad went, and I was a little kid. But I have the program from the 1951 baseball all-star game gave me.
Wow.
That's very cool.
That is awesome. Let's see what we can get for you.
All right. 1951 all-star game at Comiskey.
I think it was at Comiskey. I think it's 51. Yeah, I was a little kid.
Yeah, that's what it looks like, 51.
It was in Detroit.
Program.
It was in Detroit?
Okay.
Feature Jackie Robinson. Oh, Stan wow. Musial.
Nice.
Wow.
Dom DiMaggio.
Wow. That was Joe DiMaggio's brother. There was three brothers.
Yeah, I'm not seeing a program. I'm seeing like a ticket stub that has gone for like 122. The 1959 All-Star went for $65. So I think you'd be over $100 for that, depending on the condition.
And the Dom DiMaggio.
Right.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks, Rob.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. 312-981-7200. This is probably the end. There's some good stuff. Just maybe next time, TiVo in the box, never opened. Original Pong game, nice. Any value. Early iPods, never used. Let's finish with Jim, though, since on the line. Jim, what do you want to brag about to finish this up tonight?
I got Miami Dolphins tickets from 1960 when they were naming the team. My father-in-law called them with the name, the Dolphins, and he was the third one that sent in, so they gave him preseason Miami Dolphins tickets with the thank you letter and all the stuff behind it. But
1960
pristine
go to Miami Dolphins pristine tickets.
Nice.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Thanks, Jim. Check it out.
Yeah, we'll check it out. And
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, does that stuff go for when you talk about specific team? I mean, it's the inaugural season, right? That's right. So maybe there is something.
Yeah, I'm saying like $30 to $50,
and right. Probably so, more to actually go to the game.
Yeah,
right. Greg Flamm, of course, at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. If you want to holler at him, he joins us every Thursday night to do the swap meet here in the Download. New date. Same fun, right, Greg?
Right, always.
Good to see you, buddy. Happy
Thanks.
New Year.